Okay, today is November 21st, 2011. This is an interview with Jill Hopke. Is that how you say your last name?
Hopkey, yes.
Hopke. We're here in the conference room on the fourth floor of Steenbach Library inside the UW-Madison Archives. My name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program, and we are doing this interview specifically for a project we call Capitol Protests 2011. Thank you for coming today. The first question doesn't have much to do, unless you choose to answer it this way, with the protests of 2011. This is to give us a little bit of a context of your life, if you wouldn't mind talking about your early years and even your undergraduate, if you want. Try to bring us up to your time coming here to UW-Madison.
Okay, well, that's a big question. I grew up in the Twin Cities in Minnesota, and I guess in some ways I'll give you some background that does relate to the Capitol protests. Both of my parents are teachers. Both of them are retired now, and my stepfather worked at the University of Minnesota in a facilities management position. He wasn't a faculty member. But I grew up in the Twin Cities, and I do remember when I was very young that my mother was very involved in her union. And I hear other people mention that, as a reason for involvement in unionism, because of course the union movement is not that strong now in the United States, but having parents that were involved in unions. And so I grew up in the Twin Cities, and both my parents were teachers, and so education was always a very big focus in my life growing up. And my mom really emphasized that I would go to college one day. And so I actually did my undergraduate degree here as well at the University of Wisconsin. And I moved here originally in 1998. I did 1 year as a post-secondary student, my last year of high school, in Minnesota State University, Mankato, closer to home, and then decided to come here for a whole variety of reasons. But it was a much better school. I got accepted, and it was close to home. There's tuition recognition between Wisconsin and Minnesota, a lot of the financial considerations, which I think are much more present for students now, given the cost of attending the university has gone up significantly in the decade or so since I did my undergraduate degree here. But I finished my undergrad degree in 2002. And so I had lived in Madison, as an undergraduate student, and then stayed off and on after I finished my undergraduate degree. So do you want me to go into more detail
Let me, yeah, if you
about
don't mind,
that?
that's great. Let me, if you don't mind, we'll ask some follow-up questions about that and go from there. So where did your mother teach?
My mom taught for the St. Paul School District. I actually don't know the official name of it, but she taught in St. Paul, and for about 3 years. She's now retired, but she worked first as a teacher, a special education teacher with deaf and hard of hearing students, and then she went on. She was She filled in it temporarily as an assistant principal and found that she liked that aspect. So she finished out her career in administration. She was a principal of an elementary school in St. Paul for the last probably, I would say, 6 or 7 years of her career.
And you may have mentioned this or even alluded to it in that introduction, but so you went to you finished high school and college, basically? Is that you did your last year of, or did you already have your high school diploma and you did a year at Mankato State?
I don't know if Wisconsin has a similar program, but Minnesota, at the time that I was in high school, had a program where you could go to college for your last 2 years of your high school, your junior and senior year, and the state or the school district would pay for your tuition and books. And you had to return your books. I mean, they were owned by the school, but then you would pay room and board. Most people go somewhere kind of close. So, I lived in the Twin Cities. My stepsister was a student at Mankato Minnesota State University Mankato. They changed the name since I went there, so I'm trying to use the new name. But my sister went there, and she was a couple years ahead of me, so that's how the idea kind of came about that I could go there as well, you know, since my sister would be there. And so I essentially skipped my senior year of high school and did this called post-secondary program and went there my senior year. So I technically graduated from high school in the spring of 1998, but I had spent that academic year at college in Mankato. And I went back home for high school graduation.
Okay. Have you reflected on how you feel that basically doing your senior year at a college either benefited you or perhaps maybe didn't benefit you as you moved on or have moved on?
That's an interesting question. I think that on the whole, it benefited me. Academically, I wasn't that engaged with high school in the end. I did well in high school, but I didn't like the environment of being in high school. It felt a lot like being in prison to me. And so it was a tremendous freedom to be able to go away to college, you know, when you're 17, and make friends. And, I lived in a dorm. And it was actually a very different experience from then coming here and essentially doing a second freshman year here at Wisconsin. It's a small university. It's a state school. There's nowhere near the amount of extracurricular activities there than there were here and still are here. Sororities and fraternities are also big here, but you know, that would be, as far as social activities, one of the only social activities on the weekend might be to go to a party. The end of that year, I got a little bit involved in helping organize some campus events. And it's also another big cultural difference between Mankato and here in Madison is it's a dry campus. You know, I know Wisconsin is very unique that it is a wet campus where you can buy alcohol in the student unions. So, you know, I helped a little bit with organizing some music shows in the student union in Mankato. And nobody would go. You know, nobody would hang out in the union on a Friday night because, so that you don't have the component of being able to buy alcohol in your student union. So it wasn't a cool place. Like, the university campus was not a cool place to hang out. It was not known for having anything fun to go on in the weekend. And Mankato is also very much a commuter campus for people that commute. So the vast majority of students would leave on the weekends and go home to Twin Cities or other areas. So the big night to go out would have been a Thursday. So the culture was very different. One thing that I did really like about Mankato was I lived in a dorm my freshman year that was all freshmen. It was an all freshman dorm. And so it was easier, I guess, to make friends. It was with people that were going through that same experience as you, of being away from home for the first time, being a first-year student. And so I really liked the environment, the environment for making friends, of living in a dorm that was all freshmen. And then coming here, I was in a situation where I'd already done one freshman year, and made friends. And so, it was a little bit challenging to kind of essentially do that all over again. I found coming here to, a campus of 40,000 students, more than 40,000 students to be, it was a pretty significant shift. And academically, it was a shift too. In Mankato, everything was very easy for the most part. And I was like the top student in all of my classes by far, with the exception of an algebra class I took, actually. And maybe Spanish was difficult. But, for the most part, there was definitely an academic shift as well, that academics here were more challenging. And then, I had a couple of friends from my high school that came here. A lot of students do come to Wisconsin for school because of the reciprocity between the two states. And so, I had some friends here coming here, but it was a very overwhelming experience to go from a very small state college to the flagship university in Wisconsin.
Did you have any time during that first semester, that first year, that you felt like you had made a mistake by coming to UW-Madison? Mistake's kind of a harsh term, but at least entertained thoughts about why you came here and maybe whether that was the right the right choice for you or not?
You know, I think I always kind of felt that it was the right choice academically. You know, socially, it was hard to feel like, you know, I had made a group of friends when I had been in school in Mankato, and then to leave that environment, and it was challenging to make friends here. I lived in Salary Hall, one of the Southeast dorms. And actually, I'm still in touch with some friends that I met my second year, my freshman year here, I guess. So it was hard, you know, so I was a freshman again, but not really. So that kind of mental process of having been kind of like, oh, but I went through this all once already, was kind of jarring. And then, you know, the academics were a lot more challenging here. So that was an adjustment as well. And, you know, there were times when, you know, I had one friend from high school, her name was Stephanie, and we would be like, we don't have any other friends, you know, but we started making friends and branching out. You know, when you're 18, you can be kind of overly dramatic about a lot of things, and so I'm sure there were moments when I regretted it, but, you know, on the whole, by the end of the year of 1998, 1999, when I was here, you know, I started getting involved in some activities on campus, and it took a while to make that transition, which is probably something that a lot of transfer students, more traditional transfer students, go through when they come here.
Okay. So obviously didn't know that you went to undergraduate here, which means obviously I'm not sure of what your major was. So I want to ask it this way, though. When you came here, did you know what you wanted to major in? If so, talk about that. If not, if you talk about the process of sort of finding your way through academically to your major.
You know, I didn't know what I wanted to major in. I had worked on my high school newspaper when I was in high school, called The Odyssey, and it was actually part of a class. There was an instrumental English teacher who, you know, I had taken an AP English class, and then, you know, there was also an option to take the student newspaper as a class, which I think, you know, in reflection now, is one of the things that can make something like that, is partly extracurricular but partly academic, you know, successful. So I had worked on my high school newspaper, and I do know my parents and other people were asking me, you know, if I was going to go in the direction of doing media work. And at the time, I always said no, and I actually majored in international relations with an emphasis in environmental studies. They've changed the degree requirements around since I did the degree. It's now an international studies degree, but I got a degree in international relations with an emphasis in managing the global commons. So I did take a number of classes in what is now the Nelson Institute.
Just finishing writing that down. So what were some of the you talked about taking classes sort of through or with the Nelson Institute. Were there specific classes that that stand out in your mind, either for good reasons or perhaps not so good reasons?
There is one. It was the class I took my first semester, and it was their introductory course in kind of humanities perspective on environmental studies, and you know, I would have to go back and look at the name of the professor. It was a woman professor. I can look it up, you know who taught that class. And, you know, it's one of the classes that stands out for me. We read a book about wolves, you know, about history of wolves in Wisconsin and conservation. And it was a different way to look at the environment, I guess, you know, looking at, you know, science. You know, you can come from a very biological science perspective, but then coming from this more ecological and humanities studies perspective, definitely is something that sticks with me now. And I also remember it was a class that was actually, I remember there being a few graduate students in the class, and then so we had a discussion, you know, lecture, and then a discussion section with a TA. And I do remember one discussion that we had where we were talking about, you know, food choices that you make, you know, so where you choose to shop, for example, versus at a grocery store, or, you know, I had before then not been at all familiar with food cooperatives, and of course in Madison we have several, and the tensions. And I remember one of the other students who was a graduate student saying, you know, well, I'm a graduate student and I can't afford to buy all this expensive organic food, or talking about those tensions between, you know, living your ideals and, you know, economic realities, particularly when you're on your own and you're supporting yourself. So that's one discussion that we had in that class that sticks out in my mind. So that one, I took Bill Cronin's American Environmental History course. So that's another class that's affiliated with the Nelson Institute that stands out for me as well. I took that a couple years later. Let's see. Those are the two that I can think of right now that really stand out.
Okay. Since you did go to undergraduate here, were there, I wouldn't necessarily say extracurricular, but sort of campus-based activities or groups that you became involved in while you were here?
I, you know, the second semester of my first year got involved with WISPRG, one of the campus groups. I wasn't involved with WISPRG that much beyond my first year, but, you know, so I was involved with WISPRG for a little bit. My first year is kind of an introduction into environmental activist type activities. And then I remember going to an Earth Day fair on campus. So that would have been, of course, April 22nd, you know, so towards the end of my first year, and being introduced to the group, the UW Greens. They used to run the UW Greens info shop on campus. It's now the Madison info shop, and it's off campus on Willie Street. But it used to be an SSFC-funded student group. This would have been in, like, the spring of 1999. So I was mostly involved with the UW Greens. So starting at the very end of my first year, and then my second year here, so my junior and senior year. You know, so then for the next couple years, I was pretty involved with the UW Greens, and I worked at the UW Greens info shop.
Could you talk a little bit more about the UW Greens? Honestly, I've never heard of that before. So I'm wondering if you could talk about, you know, what their mission was and how you worked to help with that.
Sure. It's a social justice group. You know, there was always a lot of confusion about the UW Greens. And, of course, this was right around 2000 when Ralph Nader ran for president and the Green Party. And it's actually not a group that was affiliated whatsoever with the Green Party. But I do remember that we went. So I was on staff for a year, maybe a year and a half. And we used to have an office in what was University Square, the old University Square. So we had an office in there. And it just ran as kind of a multi-purpose social justice center, I guess I would say. And this was before the Red Gym opened or reopened. And then all of the kind of multicultural groups moved in there. Of course, Mecha still has their space on University. But it was a similar kind of organization to kind of what Mecha does. So, you know, we did different kinds of campaigns, like around food, for example, and fair trade. And, like, I remember at one point making a fact sheet about Cargill and industrial agriculture, and then got really involved with around, like, in 2000 and 2001, the anti-sweatshop campaign. And, of course, this is when David Ward was the chancellor for the first time. There was a sit-in at Bascom Hall, where students and community members got arrested protesting, you know, for fair trade, you know, in making university apparel. So that was something that UW Greens was very involved with. And that was around the time that the Workers' Rights Consortium started, such as a national group, which is a national organization that's pushing for fair trade practices and worker justice for people who are working in factories that produce university apparel. So that was around the time that campaign was getting started on campus. So that was run out of the UW Greens info shop. So that's giving you a sense of the kinds of, you know, social justice and economic justice kinds of issues that we worked on.
So were you directly involved in the sit-in?
A little bit. I worked at the info shop at that time, and so it served as a meeting space and kind of an information space for coordination around that. That was also the time around I started getting involved with WORT, the community radio station here in town. And so during the actual sit-in, I was taking more of a journalistic role, like journalist activist kind of role and covering the protests for the community radio station. So that would have been the winter of 2000. And so I didn't get arrested at that protest, but I was there throughout and interviewing people and then producing reports for the community radio station and also working at the info shop and taking more of a support role.
Okay. I want to ask at least one more question about your undergraduate time, because there's a, I think we can safely say, a seminal event that happened during your undergraduate time, and that's 9/11. So I'm wondering if you could talk about your memories of finding out about 9/11 and what, if anything, you did in the aftermath in terms of any sort of campus event that went on.
Well, so that was obviously a fall of 2001, and I had mentioned that I had been volunteering at the community radio station, WORT, and so what I ended up doing was I started working there as their news and public affairs director. And during, I was first interim news and public affairs director during the summer of 2001, and then was hired. The economic climate was so different back in 2001, before September 11th and before economic crash and recession that we find ourselves in now. So the fact that I was actually able to get that job, being 20 years old and not having finished college, like, it would never happen now. I mean, hearing how many people have applied for that position in subsequent times that it's been open, I don't think I wouldn't have had, it was a unique opportunity to have, you know. So I was actually hired for a full-time position at WORT towards the end of the summer of 2001. And so I just had started the permanent position around August and September of 2001. And so I was taking one, so my plan was to take one class each semester. I was 6 credits shy, because I came in with a bunch of credits when I came here, because I had gone done post-secondary in Mankato. And so I would have graduated early. You know, I had 6 credits to go, but then I had this opportunity to have this full-time job. And so I decided I would take one class each semester to finish my degree, because it does seem silly to drop out of college when you have 6 credits to graduation. So I was taking a multicultural women's literature class that fall with Nellie McKay, and that was actually another class that really sticks with me as well. So I had one class, so I went to class, I think it was twice a week, and so I was supposed to have class, that morning, so I was basically working full-time, but 2 mornings a week I would go to class. And so I remember I was living in a housing co-op then, and I remember waking up, and so I was working at a radio station, so I listened to the radio all the time. So I remember waking up and starting listening to the morning show on WORT, and all of the programming is produced by volunteers. And so the host, Dan Woodard, it was a Tuesday, so he was on the air. No, and I think what had happened was people were starting to call in. And I also didn't have a television then, so, you know, most people probably learned about that event through television, but I was actually listening to the radio. And then heard, you know, first the host broke in and said, "We're hearing reports that something happened in New York." And then a few minutes later, you know, announcing things as they were happening. And, you know, I first thought, well, I have to go to class. This, you know, I'm supposed to have class at 9:30. I have to go to class. And then, you know, so that would have been like the 8 to 9 o'clock hour as things were happening in New York, you know. And then I decided, well, I can't go to class. I have to just go straight to work, obviously. So I emailed the professor. I think actually I emailed her in the evening or later in the day to explain why I hadn't been in class. You know, so I ended up going straight to the radio station, and we spent the entire day doing special programming from the BBC and Democracy Now! Program that was then part of WBAI in New York, but it's now an independent news production, but it's part of Pacifica Radio Network, which is a lefty, more social justice-oriented version of NPR, I guess you could say. And so we were airing special programming and throughout the day and just kind of on the fly as things were developing. You know, so I didn't actually go to class that day, and I mostly spent most of my time in those weeks right after September 11th at the radio station and coordinating the programming. You know, WORT is such a unique community resource. Particularly then, you can remember back in 2001, this was before the social media phenomenon, and so there wasn't Twitter, there wasn't Facebook, which it's amazing to think in 10 years how our media environments have been, and the way that we interact socially has been so completely revolutionized. But, you know, I remember taking phone calls from people that would call us up and say, you know, so the station is based in Madison, but its listening area is most of South Central Wisconsin and doesn't reach to Milwaukee. But, you know, taking phone calls from people that were calling and saying, you know, this is the only voice of reason, you know, in my community, you know, out in the listening area outside of Madison. And so just seeing what an important medium a community radio station was at that point in time for helping provide alternative perspectives. You know, I feel like the news coverage and the national tone as a whole in that period right after September 11th was very nationalistic and very much out for revenge. You know, the U.S. then invaded Afghanistan very shortly thereafter in October of 2001. And so being a force for, you know, or a community, a space for dialogue and airing of perspectives that are saying, you know, even in this time of crisis, even in response to this horrific act of terrorism, you know, there could still be space to talk about peace and justice. And the way that it served as a community resource, both in terms of news and public affairs programming, but also in terms of music and culture, and really seeing what an important resource that was. So that was what I spent most of my time doing in that period. You know, so I was taking one class then, but I wasn't super linked into the university community as a whole. Mm-hmm. You know, it was, we had some discussions in my class about it, and you know, and I remember getting an email back from my professor saying, you know, oh, it was fine that I missed class, and that the class that I ended up spending the whole time talking about what had happened in New York anyway.
And we may, as we go along here, we may sort of talk about the post 9/11 world as we talk about some of these other things. So I assume you did graduate in the spring. Mm-hmm. Of what would then be 2002.
Yes, I graduated in May of 2002.
At that point, what were your future plans?
Well, at that point, I definitely did not plan to go to graduate school. I was working at the radio station. I had taken an urban and regional planning class the spring semester, and I did almost not take a class the spring semester. It was very overwhelming to work somewhere like WORT in a period, in a post September 11th period, and the way the world changed and U.S. politics and foreign policy changed so significantly. And, you know, first the invasion of Afghanistan and then Iraq, you know, subsequently in 2003, you know, so it was a difficult period to also juggle all of that with being a student. But I had several friends that very wisely advised me that it would be, you know, to just take another class and get it out of the way, because at that point, certainly it would have been harder to come back, and I only needed 3 credits to graduate. So I did end up taking a class that spring semester in 2002 and graduating in May of that year. And, you know, at that point, you know, I was working at the radio station, and I worked there for about another year and a half. And I was getting more involved with independent media. And so I kind of saw myself going in that direction. And I told you earlier that I had majored in international relations. And it was a really interesting degree to have. But again, it was the kind of degree where there's no clear career path, which is something my mother reminded me of many times as an undergraduate student, or asked me many times what I was going to do with that degree. And so, you know, that's a challenging thing for a university, right, is you're providing students with a breadth at the undergraduate level, with a breadth of exposure to different ideas and theories and the whole liberal arts education as a whole, but we now live in a society that's increasingly geared towards outcomes and being able to say, I have this degree and I can do X with it, which I think is a challenge facing the university system as a whole. The way that we think about higher education is beginning to shift. So I continued working at WRT, and I wouldn't say that I had a clear career path in mind, to be honest, but I was very passionate about community media and independent media, particularly in a post-September 11th context, and the importance of having alternative views in news, and kind of the empowerment processes along with having those kinds of community spaces.
Okay. So when did graduate school start to become more than an idea but an actuality?
Well, in 2004, I left working at WORT, and I went down to El Salvador for 6 months and volunteered. And I was primarily teaching English at a social justice-focused language school or community organization, NGO, in San Salvador. But at the time, I also visited some community radio stations because that's an interest of mine. And there's one radio station, it's called Radio Victoria, and it's in the northern region of El Salvador called Cabañas. And WRT actually has had a more of a longstanding relationship with this community radio station in El Salvador. And we had some staff from that station, it's mostly run by youth, come and visit us before I left for El Salvador. So I went and spent some time there, not a whole lot. You know, I wasn't so confident about my Spanish skills. So I did spend most of my time living in San Salvador, which is the capital. But it was really pivotal to visit that community radio station in rural El Salvador and see what a force it was in that community, and also see how, in many ways, how similar it was to what we were doing at WRT in Madison. And, you know, I remember observing a literature show on Radio Victoria, and it was like all of the microphones except for one were broken, so the host and the guest were both like huddled around one microphone, you know, like reading literature. And it struck me to be so similar to WRT, just in the feel and the philosophy and the community building functions that served, and seeing that in more of in a global South context, in rural, more underdeveloped areas of the world. And so I spent some time there in 2004, and then when I came back originally from El Salvador in the end of summer of 2004, I started I had a couple part-time jobs, one of which was in a temp position at Wisconsin Public Radio. So I continued working in media, and I went back in 2005 for a month and spent more time there, and then did interviews and became more interested in, you know, how community radio works in development state context. And so that was when I first started getting the idea of coming to graduate school and thinking about, you know, how I would be interested in researching something like that. But also the teaching, and I found it really gratifying to have, you know, this experience of cultural exchange with people, you know, that had been doing something similar to me, but in a very different context. And I also, through my work at WRT, really enjoyed teaching, the informal teaching and providing instruction and running workshops. And so I thought that I would like, started to think about how I would like to go to graduate school to teach and also research something that I'm passionate about, you know, professionally. And so that was in 2005. And I didn't come back to graduate school until the fall of 2007, but that was when I started thinking about it.
And I will officially ask why, of all the graduate schools you possibly could have gone to, why UW-Madison?
So I ended up coming back to school for journalism, and I got my master's from the School of Journalism and Mass Communication, though I'm now doing my PhD in the Department of Life Sciences Communication in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. You know, it's one of the top programs in the country, and it's here in Madison. You know, I wish I had a more flowery reason for saying why I came here. You know, there are a lot of reasons. I was accepted. It's a good program. You know, it's here in town. So those would be the main reasons. And it ended up being a really good fit with what I wanted to do. But I did find the process of researching graduate schools to be difficult. I mean, I don't come from a family, like my mom had gone back to school, you know, when she became a principal. But I don't come from a family where that many people have gone to graduate school. And so it wasn't something that was very intuitive to me. And so the process of navigating, taking the GRE, researching schools and figuring out what were good schools and looking at various rankings, Like, I feel like it's something, like, you don't really understand academia until you're in it, and being an undergraduate student is vastly different, you know, and having gone to the same university as an undergraduate student, as a graduate student, I can say the experience is totally different. So that's how I ended up coming back here for graduate school.
Okay. You alluded to this, too, but I'm going to ask it directly. So it appears from what you said that being here in Madison had something to do with it, too. So my question is, what is it about the city or the area that you obviously enjoy enough that you wanted to stay here for graduate school?
I really like so many things about Madison. Having a space like WRT, which, you know, I was very involved with, different kinds of, like, I was also involved with WYOU, the community television station. After I had been doing radio for a while, I decided to try out video. So the different kinds of independent community arts and media type organizations. I did some work or was involved a little bit with Wiskino, which is an independent filmmaking collaborative. I wasn't involved in organizing it at all, but they used to have monthly screenings. So there are a lot of those kinds of opportunities here in Madison. For a city its size, it has quite a bit of cultural offerings.
Okay. So you mentioned in your mind that undergraduate here is vastly different than graduate school here. Do you have examples that stand out in your mind to answer a question if I ask you why?
Sure. Well, you know, I mentioned to you that I did my undergraduate degree in international relations, which is a very, and I can't speak to how it's set up now, but the way that there were four tracks, and some of them were area studies, and there was one that was like an international business focus one, and then I did an environmental focus one. So of any department, you know, I took a number of classes through the Nelson Institute, which also is made, you know, is very interdisciplinary and has lots of different perspectives coming into it as well. So that even in itself isn't one department. But, you know, I was taking a lot of different classes in different areas, so I didn't feel that I had one department that was an academic home. Like, when I was trying to think about applying to graduate school, it was hard to come up with a list of professors that I could ask. And it wasn't because I didn't do well as an undergraduate student, but because of the interdisciplinary nature of that degree, I would take one class here, one class in agriculture economics, one class in biology, you know, another class that was in, you know, the core environmental studies class, environmental history in the history department. And so I didn't have one program that I felt that I was really part of. And I think this is something that the university struggles with as a whole, is, you know, how to provide coherence for undergraduate students and academic advising for undergraduate students. But then coming back as a graduate student and being in one program, you know, working very closely with professors and developing kind of a mentor-mentee relationship, both in the journalism school and also in life sciences communication, where you're taking most of your classes in that department and you're kind of an apprentice, an intellectual apprentice, and you're being mentored into how to, and socialized into how to become an academic, and there are more resources available to you and more attention as a graduate student, that I found the experience to be very different. And that there are a lot more resources for graduate students. And, you know, this is a lot, my experience was very shaped by what I chose as a major. Mm-hmm. You know, I see the undergraduate students in life sciences communication, for example, which is a very small department on campus. And I imagine had I majored in something like that, you know, like what my degree is now as an undergraduate, that my experience probably would have been totally different.
So who was it in the School of Journalism that you were their his or her intellectual apprentice?
Well, my master's advisor is Joellen Fair. And her focus, she does international communication, and I took a seminar with her on media ethnographies in my second semester of graduate school in the spring of 2008. And she mostly studies African media and African cultural studies. So, you know, area studies-wise, it isn't necessarily the best match with what direction I've gone in, but she was a wonderful advisor. and definitely gave me the intellectual freedom to pursue what I wanted. What I did for my master's thesis is I did a case study of the Latin American Association of Radio Education, which is an association of community radio stations in Latin America. They have over 100 affiliates in 17 countries, and they're headquartered in Quito, Ecuador. So I actually got a small research grant from the Latin American, Caribbean, and Iberian Studies program, LACIS, here on campus to go do field work the summer after my first year of graduate school. So I spent 10 weeks in Quito working or doing participant observation research in the headquarters of ALAIR, it's the acronym for the organization, and then based my master's thesis on that. And she was very supportive of, you know, I think, you know, like I came to her, you know, having just started taking her class in January and you know, for advice about applying for this grant that was due in February. And she said she would write me a letter of recommendation. And I always had a lot of faith in my abilities to conduct, you know, the international field work for the first time. And I hadn't taken a methods course at all, you know, and said, oh, well, just read these couple books and you're going to be fine. And you know, gave me advice throughout the process, both of conducting the research and also when I came back, you know, guiding me through the process of writing up the research.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so while you were pursuing the master's degree, were you thinking at that point about going on to get a terminal degree in something, or were you looking at the master's as a terminal degree that you would then apply into the workforce?
You know, I was thinking about both. I came back to graduate school thinking that I would pursue a PhD, but I did consider my second year of graduate school, leaving graduate school and applying for jobs. You know, that was around January, February of 2007. No, I guess this would have been end of 2008 going into 2009, right at the height of the economic recession. You know, and so then I thought to myself, well, graduate school's been really great, and you know, I feel so much smarter now, and I can think about things so differently, you know, and really expanded my boundaries as far as what I thought that I was capable of. For example, taking statistics, I ended up taking 4 semesters of statistics and, you know, came back to graduate school being completely fearful of something like that. And so pushing myself intellectually, but then I thought, well, what can I do with this? And that's, you know, that's the tension, I think, when you are taking an academic track, is how do you translate that into something that would be applicable skills outside of academia is challenging. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't really feel like at that point, combined with the type of training that I got in graduate school, as well as the realities of the economic recession, that I would be able to find a job doing something that different than what I had been doing before, which had been working in nonprofit media fundraising. And so I ended up deciding, well, if I'm ever going to continue, I might as well do it now. This is the time to be in school, if any. So I ended up deciding to stay, and I switched to life sciences communication for a PhD. And the reason why I did that was mostly life sciences communication has a very applied approach to doing research that attracted me to that program. And there are also professors that do more international research. And there was a professor who is actually now in the journalism school, but who at the time was in life sciences communication, who did international research in Latin America. He's originally from Colombia and does projects there. And so there were kind of, I guess, the main reasons why I ended up deciding to finish the master's in journalism and then switch for the PhD as my academic home to life sciences communication.
Okay. A couple more things for today to sort of set the stage for our follow-up interview. So the first question is, were you involved in politics before February 2011?
Yes. You know, I have told you about how I was involved with the UW Greens as an undergraduate student and more around environmental issues and some with fair trade and food-related issues. You know, and then I feel that working in community and independent media is a form of politics and political engagement. Most people that are attracted to volunteering somewhere like WORT are people that are passionate about various activist issues, whether it be politics or social or economic issues, and they carry that passion into the coverage that they do. You know, and most people cover things that they are involved with activist-wise outside of media and outside of the radio station. So I always felt that working at WRT was a form of activism and community service, you know, working at the radio station. You know, when I first came back to graduate school, well, and I guess what I will mention briefly is I worked at the Progressive magazine before I came back to school for a couple years, and, you know, which is a social justice publication founded by Bob La Follette in 1909, you know, of course, a very big figure in Progressive era politics in Wisconsin. And so while working at the Progressive magazine, I worked as a union steward. So both at WRT, we actually were affiliated with SEIU, which is the Service Employees International Union, which mostly works with healthcare workers. You know, I've always, before coming back to graduate school, I worked at very small places. And so, but if they're social justice organizations, people running them feel like we should have a union. But then when you're only six people in your collective bargaining unit, it's very hard to find a union that will take you. And so, you know, at WRT, we had a union, and we were all involved in the process of negotiating a contract. But we were affiliated with SEIU, which is a little bit of an odd fit. And then I would later worked at the Progressive magazine, and we also had a union there, and we were affiliated with the National Organization of Legal Service Workers, which is part of the United Auto Workers. So again, maybe a little bit of a odd fit. You know, so I had experience being involved with unions in a couple workplaces before I came back to graduate school. And I worked, and I was a union steward at the Progressive, and that was a very formative experience. I actually negotiated a couple grievances as a union steward while at the Progressive, which the details are irrelevant. But it was formative in the sense for me of seeing how important it is to have a voice in your workplace and be able to collectively represent yourselves, regardless of the type of workplace that is, mm-hmm. you know, that is important. Mm-hmm. And so I came back to graduate school in the fall of 2007. And, you know, I was not very involved in the TAA my first couple years of graduate school. You know, I joined the TAA. I did a little bit of volunteering my first year editing a newsletter. But I mostly, you know, I came back to school because I was really committed in advancing my own education. And so I focused most of my time and energy on that. So I got a little bit more involved with the TAA in the past year. So before February of 2011, I had been getting more involved with the TAA, and I had been a member for the previous few years and had past experience being involved with unions, but I wouldn't say that I was the most politically involved prior to February of 2011.
Well, you jumped my second question, which was to ask about your involvement in the TAA, which is what I was going to ask after. So you just mentioned that. I'm wondering though if there are things you want to add to. You say you became more involved in the TAA pre February 11, and you just talked about that a little bit. Is there anything else you want to add about your involvement in the TAA pre February 2011?
Well, you know, the longer I was in graduate school, and so this last year was my fourth year of graduate school. So towards the end of my third year of graduate school, I realized that I did want to spend more time doing things that weren't, I wanted to have some other kinds of outside activities, you know, that I wanted to be more involved in something else that wasn't just doing research. You know, after being in school for several years, you know, I have stayed involved with WRT a little bit. Not as much as I would ideally like, you know, but that I did want to do something outside of the classroom and outside of research. And so I started doing a little bit of volunteering with the TAA, not a whole lot, but the fall of my fourth year, so last year. And a friend and I actually decided, you know, we thought the TAA needed help with publicity. This is, and with the election last fall, I think everybody was worried about what was going to happen when Scott Walker became governor. Mm-hmm. You know, we were all very aware. And in December, you know, when You know, so I wasn't involved with negotiating the contract, but when the state employee unions negotiated contracts, and this is a piece that gets lost as people retell the history of what happened, that it was actually the Democrats, when they controlled both of the chambers and legislature and the governorship, failed to ratify. Doyle, you know, said he would have signed the contracts, but that they failed to approve our contracts, and the governor would have signed them. Of course, that would have only protected us until like July of this year. It would have only pushed things back maybe 6 months. But when that happened, you know, right around the end of the semester last fall, in December, all of a sudden there was a lot of concern about what was happening. So I think that was kind of setting the stage for, well, of course, we had no idea that there was going to be a Capitol occupation and mass protests. But, you know, in January, I went to a retreat, a TAA retreat, and, you know, we were very concerned about what was going on and planning. And that was where the idea for having the February 14th demonstration, the I Heart UW, Walker Don't Break My Heart demonstration, came out of that discussion in January over winter break, because we knew that there were going to be significant cuts to higher education funding in the budget, and we knew that he was supposed to announce the budget in the beginning of March, end of February, early March. So that's why we chose that day where we were planning that demonstration. And it was during that workshop. It was like I was there maybe 3 or 4 hours, and I kind of thought, oh, the TA needs help with publicity. And so, you know, another friend of mine who's a graduate student in the journalism school and I were talking, you know, and deciding that we wanted to help with publicity. And so we actually decided to restart the TAA publicity committee right before Walker announced the budget repair bill, and we had our first meeting. It would have been like the first or second week of February, you know, in advance of the February 14th demonstration. And we had a couple people that then wrote a press release, and I wrote an op-ed that was published in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about higher education funding, and Walker's big campaign promise was to create 250,000 jobs. And in his State of the State speech, he talked about this high-tech workforce that we need, and this global competition, you know, that we're facing, and then creating these 250,000 jobs, but then this disconnect between why are you cutting hundreds of millions of dollars from higher education when you're saying that you need a highly trained workforce? It just doesn't make any sense. And so we started doing a little bit of publicity work. It happened to be completely happenstance, you know, right before Walker announced the bill on the 11th of February. So that definitely positioned us well as far as doing media work for the TAA and what became the Capitol occupation.
Okay. We're at a point where, and this is more me than you, that I'm. I think it's a good stopping point for today. I always try to leave the narrator with the last word, meaning is there anything that's, as you've been talking about this, is there anything on your mind? And it could be things happen after February 11th, but you would like to get on the record in case we don't get a chance to, you don't get a chance to talk about it either in the follow-up or if we do another interview. So basically, this is a chance for you to, if you got something on your mind, to get it off your chest before we close for today.
I guess there's one thing, you know, we talked at, so I think next time we'll talk more in detail about organizing for the TAA in February and March, and I had mentioned to you that I was involved with the media aspect of that and social media, and I know that was something that you wanted to talk about. But we talked at the beginning about, you asked about my family and growing up, and there was one thing that was a formative experience that I guess I wanted to mention that I haven't yet is, you know, I told you that my parents were teachers, and my mom was very involved in her union. She was on a bargaining team at one point. And I remember the first demonstration that I ever attended was with my mother. And it was this time when they were negotiating a contract. I was probably 5 or 6 years old. And they had a demonstration at the St. Paul School's administration building, and they ended up not going on strike. They made some kind of last minute deal. But I remember going with my mother to a demonstration where they were throwing old shoes into a pile, and the metaphor, the message that they were using is, you know, they're walking in a circle and just piling shoes in the lobby of the school district administration, because that, you know, they're trying to send this message that they were being walked all over. And I remember that demonstration, and I just remember walking in circles and throwing shoes in a pile. You know, I was very young at that point, but it was something that I thought back about. I reflected on some, in February and March with everything that was going on here, and talked with my mother about in the summer a little bit, and she said that it was really, so partly it was about economic issues, it was about raises, but what it was more about was about respect, and having respect for their labor as teachers, and the work that they did with children, and about just having respect in the workplace. And I think that that's the same thing that we've been fighting for here in Wisconsin, that the economic issues are important and they're affecting all of us who are state workers right now and will continue to do so, especially after January when there are additional co-pays for our health insurance. But the underlying issue to me is about respect.
Jill, I want to thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate
it.
Okay, today is November 23rd, 2011. This is a second interview, or the second interview, with Jill Hopke. We're here in my office inside the University Archives, which is inside Steenbach Library, and this interview is being done for the Capitol Protest 2011 Oral History Project, and I'm Troy Reeves. Jill, thanks for coming.
No problem.
To check the sound here, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Jill Hopke, and my last name is spelled H-O-P-K-E.
Thank you. Okay, so when we left off, we had basically got ourselves to the to February 2011. You had talked about how you and another TAA member had revivified the publicity committee, and the TAA was marching towards their February 14th event. So I'm wondering, I'm going to ask to start off with, if you have specific memories about hearing about the budget repair bill.
Yes, I actually remember it quite well when I first heard about the bill. Last spring semester, I had a Thursday evening class. It's an English class with a professor, John McKenzie. So it's over at College Library in their media lab. And so a friend of mine named Chris is in the class, and he's also a little bit involved with the TAA. I think he had been at our first publicity meeting. He's a grad student in the Comm Arts department here. And so we got done with class. I think our class ended at 8 p.m. In late in the evening, we got done with class, and he called my attention. He said, "Oh, come over here, take a look at this." And he had Madison.com, the local newspaper website, open, and he pointed out an article. The news had been leaked that Thursday evening that the next morning Governor Walker was going to be announcing the budget repair bill, and he said, "Look at this. This would essentially get, we read the article together, and we started talking about how this would essentially get rid of all of our collective bargaining rights and do away with unions." And the professor came over because we had stayed after class and said, what's going on?" So we pointed it out to him too. And so I remember that moment quite well, hearing about it and thinking, "Oh my God, this is going to be big." It had come out of nowhere. I had watched the governor's State of the State address about a week and a half or so before this, and he had been singling out state workers, but no mention of essentially trying to kill unions in the state for public sector workers. And so I think right away then it kind of hit me that it was going to be big. And so, I think when I got home, I maybe sent some emails, or there were those of us that had been at that first meeting of the TAA publicity. We weren't officially constituted as the committee at that point, but we had one meeting the previous week. So, I emailed with some people, "Oh, should we meet tomorrow?" I mean, there was this sense that, I felt a sense that we needed to do something right away and respond to it right away, or kick into action. Particularly because we had this event planned for Monday, and we had been expecting around probably 100 people. We put out a press release, and we probably said hundreds of students. You know, you never know how many people are going to come to a demonstration, like an average university demonstration, where you kind of march from one end of State Street to the other end of State Street. You know, so the plan was to meet at the Union and march up State Street and deliver these Valentines to the governor. And so right away, you know, that demonstration took on, or began to take on, a different tone. You know, it took on a lot more significance that it was happening the Monday after this bill was announced. And so another person from the TA publicity committee and I decided that we would meet like 4 p.m. on Friday after we both got done with our teaching and campus obligations. She's also a grad student in the Comm Arts department. And so that Friday, we met at the TAA office, and it was a buzz with, I want to say dozens, but anyway, a lot of activity, a lot of people gathered, and I think it felt urgent. You know, there was a sense of urgency to take action. You know, the reports that we were getting over that weekend were that the Republicans wanted to force a vote on this bill the next week, you know, and that they were trying to push this bill through. When I say they, I mean the Republicans in the legislature were trying to push this bill through over the course of less than a week. And this would be, you know, rolling back 50 years of collective bargaining rights for public sector workers in Wisconsin in less than a week. You know, it took on a lot of significance, one, because of the content of what Governor Walker was trying to do, but also, two, because of the time frame and how quickly the Republicans were moving to try to push this through. So, which I think helped us. I think it helped us to galvanize opposition, you know, that there was a sense of urgency and that it was so quick and that it was so unexpected, actually played in our favor. Because you think, you know, I think about all of the emails I get, whether they're from the TAA, whether they're from the union, or from some other activist source. And, you know, a lot of times everything seems urgent, right? Or, you know, they're trying to get you to do something all of the time. And there's, it's only so often when you have a critical spark, a moment. And so I think the urgency of it and this sense, and also Governor Walker made statements that Friday, which got in the mainstream news and I think even a little bit of a national attention over the weekend, that he had said, he made a comment reference that he would call out the National Guard, I think specifically in regard to if prison workers decide, you know, walked off the job. But that even pushed it even further, that he announced the bill right away and was already making these kind of confrontational, escalating, you know, fear-mongering type comments. And so I think that helped us. But anyway, you had just asked me to explain a little bit of the context, so I'll stop there for now.
No, that's great. So actually what I'm hoping to do with this is to sort of go a little bit of stream of consciousness and just your memories as the protests progress, and then I'll jump in with specific questions, and if you want to specifically address your role with the media part of it, you can do that. If not, I'll be following up about that anyway. Mm-hmm. So let's move to, unless there was something that weekend between the announcement and the 14th, unless there's something in that weekend that stands out in your mind, you feel like you need to speak to, why don't we next talk about the February 14th event?
Well, let me say a couple more things.
Sure.
About that weekend.
Sure.
And about the TAA. What really struck me, and I alluded to it already, is just, again, this sense of urgency and bringing out a lot of people that otherwise hadn't been active in the union, both of the co-presidents were actually out of town that first weekend, or coming back into town that first weekend. And so, you know, I don't want to say there was a void in leadership, because there certainly wasn't, but it was a situation that was this heightened critical moment. And so I had this feeling that everybody was doing what they could. And, you know, this continued throughout the entire occupation. And, you know, there were tensions between formalized organizational structure and decision-making processes and the need to make decisions quickly and react, you know, tactically to something, you know, to events as they are evolving very quickly. And this is a tension within the organization that I think we saw throughout the what became the Capitol occupation is, you know, kind of pushing the limits of what, you know, an organization like the TAA is certainly not designed with the idea of occupying the state capitol in mind and being the center of national spotlight. It's designed to negotiate contracts, to be, you know, a democratic decision, you know, have democratic decision-making processes and follow Robert's rules of order and meetings that take a very long time to sometimes make decisions about things that are relatively small in scale. And so there were a lot of tensions, I think, that arose around organizational structure. But on the whole, I think that the organization really rose to the occasion of confronting this attack on workers' rights. And so that weekend, you know, both Friday, I was there late into the night, all day Saturday, all day Sunday, maybe 12 to 16 hours. And there were many people in a similar situation as me. We started phone banking members right away. That's not something that I know I was personally doing the media stuff, but other TAA members and volunteers started phone banking our membership. We did our first canvas. We participated in a larger, it might have been either AFT or actually I think it was AFL-CIO organized canvassing. So I drove with some friends out to Dale Schultz's district that Sunday, you know, a couple of days after the bill was announced, and we spent the afternoon knocking on union members' doors. We were going specifically to union households because the tactic at that point was to try to get, and Peter Rickman kept saying five, and I don't know, I get five Republicans to vote no. Like, the idea is, like, you needed three votes to vote, to swing, you know, to for the bill to fail, but they needed to vote as a group. So the tactic at that point was to work within the legislative process and convince more moderate Republican senators, Dale Schultz being one of them and being the only Republican senator that did actually vote no on the bill in the end, to vote no. And so what we were doing is, when we did that canvas, is we were going to union members' households in Dale Schultz's district, and, you know, and I was really struck by people who had heard about the bill, that, you know, many of the people we talked to said, I already called him, I'll call again, I tried calling and I couldn't get through. So I think that there was this overall sense of mobilization or people taking action, you know, so it wasn't just the TAA, but the TAA had one, I think, critical piece, you know, but we're a relatively small state worker union, but a critical piece in this larger picture of trying to pressure the Republicans, you know, on this issue. So I guess I'll stop there with that weekend. But it kind of set this tone of, again, urgency, like I said, and kind of coming together and everybody contributing what they could to this effort. We found out sometime Sunday that there was going to be a public hearing on Tuesday the 15th, and there was going to be one public hearing, and it was going to be on Tuesday the 15th. And we got that information at some point in Sunday. So there was this constant shifting of, you know, new information that would be coming out, and tactics, and things were changing relatively quickly. You know, so we started not only, you know, finalizing our plans for the demonstration on the 14th, but looking ahead to planning for what we were going to do for the day of the public hearing on the 15th. And as far as media stuff, over the weekend, we put together talking points, more social media, and following up. Obviously, our event took on a lot more significance and was getting more media attention than it otherwise would have. And we trained spokespeople. We found, you know, our members and then a couple, at least one undergraduate student that was from, with people that were from Wisconsin and, you know, kind of have that Wisconsin family tie that could be spokespeople, and we had meetings with them to kind of talk about talking points and think strategically about how we wanted to present the issue and how we wanted to present ourselves as graduate student work and as workers. And the university, because there was a dual message of, one, the message was about collective bargaining rights, and the message, you know, the original message was more about education funding. So kind of trying to merge those two and make a connection between what are our working conditions as graduate students and faculty and academic staff, what are our working conditions, our learning conditions for students, and making those broader links. And I do want to mention that we worked with undergraduate students from the Student Labor Action Coalition, and also, you know, some key individuals from the Associated Students of Madison. And that was one of the things that surprised me and helped me really realize the significance of all of this, is that it was bringing in not what you would consider to be core labor constituencies, that it wasn't just those of us that are directly affected that were active and speaking out, but it was also our allies amongst graduate students. And I can come back to that later, because they really did also some innovative things with social media and organizing.
Okay, great. I do want to ask one specific question, because we never know who's going to read this and how far in the future and what political strategies and tactics will be. Mm-hmm. So would you mind defining phone banking, and then specifically what type of phone banking you were doing that weekend? I think you said it wasn't necessarily you, but just sort of the TAA in general.
Right. Yeah, I didn't actually do phone banking myself. But, you know, so what it is, you know, well, we have our own member TAA membership roles. There's approximately 3,000 project assistants and teaching assistants on campus. Of that, approximately half at that point were members. And so we have various amounts of contact information for those individuals, right? You know, the university provides just basic information on somebody's name, their unit, the type of position they have, and like their office address and email. But then when they join, we also usually get a phone number, potentially a non-university email and an address. So we have a list, you know, a membership list. And so phone banking is essentially just going through and calling all of your members. So they would get a membership email, but, you know, we know people don't always open emails or might skim over them or not read them. So when something is deemed urgent and of such scale significance that you want to get people to come to the rally Monday, you want to get people to come to the public hearing on Tuesday, you know, what we and inform them about what was going on, obviously, because it was new and maybe not everybody was paying attention to the news. Just calling through the member lists and having conversations with members, or at minimum, you know, leaving voicemails and telling people, you know, what was going on. And so, you know, we definitely called all of our own members, and I believe, you know, we might have also been phone banking other unions. The TAA office became a phone banking center as the occupation developed, and through the Supreme Court election, I don't think we offered it as a phone banking site during the summer recalls, since we didn't have so many of our members around, but it became a site. You know, there was the Capitol occupation that was going on, and then there was parallel, you know, there was a TAA office as a site for phone banking. So we weren't, you know, at the beginning, we were mostly, I think, phone banking our own members, but as things progressed, we were also serving as a site to phone bank more generally.
All right. Thank you. So I think that leads us to Valentine's Day, and what was going to be one type of rally turned into something a little different. Mm-hmm. So if you mind talking about your memories of that day specifically, and then if you want to sort of move on how that built, or we can ask follow-ups about that depending on how it goes.
Sure. So I gave you a little bit of background about how we prepared for the media strategy. You know, the meeting point was in front of Memorial Union, and we had one of our members got red balloons, helium balloons, and we gave those to the spokespeople. You know, the idea was, you know, when reporters came, we could say, oh, talk to that person or talk to somebody that has a red balloon. You know, the system didn't work quite as well as we might have hoped, because I couldn't necessarily find everyone, you know, and a lot of times I found that if you have a clipboard, you look official and reporters want to talk to you. So I had a clipboard. And so I ended up getting interviewed by a reporter from Wisconsin Public Radio and also one television station. I think just because I had a clipboard and I looked official, it was like I was organizing something. So the clipboard as a universal signifier of being an organizer, apparently. But overall, I think the system worked all right. But, you know, so there's that, you know, as an activist, you want reporters to talk to people that are that you've kind of trained and that you've given the official line and the talking points, and this is why we're doing this, and we've thought about messaging. But, you know, I've also been a reporter. You know, if you're a reporter, you kind of just want to talk to anyone, right? You know, you want to just find somebody who's just there, and you don't necessarily want the scripted official line. So there's always that tension between trying to have people in your organization and the undergraduate staff, faculty, community members that showed up to be presenting the message that, that we wanted to get across, and then just the nature of that kind of ever-shifting media landscape, or, you know, as an event is unfolding, you know, reporters will just talk to anyone. So I remember it being a really sunny day. You know, we actually had very nice weather in mid-February for Wisconsin, and I think that's something completely out of our control that really helped, is that I remember it being a bright, sunny day, and there was a pretty large crowd of us. I don't really feel like I had the sense that it was big until we started marching up State Street, and it took up a few blocks, and as we got to the Capitol, and so we were handing out, there had also been sign making over the weekend at the TA office, so people were handing out signs. And some other grad students from my department came. I had sent out an email to all of the graduate employees in my department on Sunday, you know, giving some background and saying, I'm going to go to this demonstration Monday. If you want to come with me, we can meet at 11:30. I think it was supposed to start at noon. And so we can meet at 11:30 at our office, and we can walk together. So then there was four of us that went together. And that was kind of nice to get people in my department to come. You know, there was a lot of interest. And so I tried to continue that throughout the spring. It's just giving people information and sending out periodic emails. Because even for people that weren't actively involved, there was a lack of information and things were changing quickly. And so I think it was important to keep people informed about what was happening. And as things shifted quickly. So we had started with this message of I heart UW, Governor Walker, don't break my heart. And so one thing that was cool that the undergraduate students did from the Student Labor Action Coalition, or the acronym is SLAC, is started this kind of hands off our teachers. And so, you know, on Twitter, you know, we had the hashtag hands off our teachers. It's a little bit long for a hashtag, but hands off our teachers. And again, I talked about that coalition between the undergraduate students and us as teaching assistants as being real important. So it was nice to have their energy and their enthusiasm too, and making those links. And we also actually over the weekend had set up this website, Defend Wisconsin, defendwisconsin.org, and a parallel Twitter account, which became very important during the Capitol occupation, Defend Wisconsin. And so we set that up on Saturday or Sunday at some point. And so we kicked it off Sunday. And so, you know, the first day we had, I think we had one of the undergraduate students was tweeting, like, we're going to march up State Street now. You know, and if you want to find out what's happening, follow this Twitter account. Because we started off with no followers, right? And now I think we're up to about 6,500 followers on Twitter. And so we kicked things off that way. You know, I remember marching up State Street. I remember there being a really good energy to it. Things were pretty depressing over the weekend, but going on canvassing on Sunday and getting a pretty much unanimous positive response, and people had heard about the bill, they had called Dale Schultz, and then combining that with Monday, there was a good energy, and, you know, having undergraduate and graduate students and other community members there. And I remember going into the Capitol, and as we were going into the rotunda area, and it's very echoey. It was, you know, obviously I got used to it later, but it was that first moment when we were going in there and we were walking as a group and we were chanting, kill the bill, kill the bill, kill the... So the initial hashtag that we were using was kill this bill and kill the bill. So we were starting off with those hashtags on Twitter. So that was the main chant, was kill the bill, kill the bill, kill the bill. And, you know, we were streaming into the rotunda and chanting, and you know, it filled up the entire Capitol, and we had all of the signs with hearts and balloons, and there was a very positive energy about it, even though it was a very serious issue. From a framing perspective, I think it was really good, you know, and it was Valentine's Day to use this messaging and imagery of hearts and love and kind of a very soft, positive tone to a demonstration. So we delivered the Valentines and piled them up on a desk. They knew, the governor's office, I think, knew we were coming. So there was a desk set up in front of his office, and it was blocked off by some security. So we weren't able to go into the office to deliver them, but piled them on this desk in front of his office. And then we stayed there for a little bit, and then we basically marched back outside, and we're outside the Capitol for a little bit, and then just telling everybody, come back tomorrow for this public hearing. So that was the tone of the first day, you know. And then after that, we had a general member. The TAA is run on a structure where there are general membership meetings, or called GMMs, and those are meetings, you know, any meeting is open to all members, but those are meetings for the membership. And so there was a GMM that evening in the Humanities Building on campus. And I want to say at least, there was probably at least 100, maybe 150 people that came to that meeting. So, you know, went back to the TA office and were preparing for that meeting, and different constituencies within the union were going to present. So I think that I stood up and said a few things about media, and so graduate assistants, whether they were members or not, you know, were wondering what was happening, and people were signing up. I remember a lot of times during the Capitol occupation, there were a lot of people that were signing up for the first time, that hadn't been members previously, so. There'd be a couple people that would be in their blue cards. Like, becoming a member is you fill out a card, you sign a membership card, and ours were blue. So piles of those around where people were signing up. So there was a membership meeting that evening, mostly informational, and again, trying to mobilize people to come Tuesday on the 15th of February to the public hearing the next morning and testify and try to kind of pack the hearing and get lots of people testifying and pack the Capitol and, again, get more people to turn out the next day. And then I was participated in a meeting that was after that, that was more of a tactical meeting, and that was at one of the coffee shops on State Street that I don't go to that often. I forget the name of the one that was at, but we had a meeting at a coffee shop on State Street to talk strategy, because there were different kinds of parallel types of organizing going on. You know, I was doing media stuff, and we were going to be continuing that the next day at the public hearing, and then there were a couple other people that were doing, again, running phone banking out of the TA office and continuing to do canvassing. And then there was a piece of, like, keeping members informed and then figuring out, you know, who was going to get there first thing in the morning when the hearing opened, who was going to be in charge of kind of getting TAA members to the right place to testify. And, you know, it's hard to get on the wireless internet connection at the Capitol. So who would get there earliest, who could get internet connections. And so talking about that kind of strategy. And that, so that was the evening of the 14th, and then leading into the public hearing on the 15th.
Okay. So you've been working at this point long days, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. And do you recall at this point, are you on adrenaline? How do you physically feel after these 4 days of go, 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 go?
Well, I guess I would say exhausted. I made it until about the middle of the second week of the demonstrations before I got sick. I did end up getting sick about 2 weeks into it, because there's only so long that you can go on adrenaline alone. Because it certainly only got worse after that point. You know, that was just going into essentially the second day of the demonstrations. I was a teaching assistant last spring and TAing for a course in my department. It's called LSC 100. It's an introduction to Introduction to Composition and Public Speaking course. So it meets Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. So I would teach, last semester I was teaching Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9:30 to 10:45. So I didn't have to teach on that Tuesday. Did I have class that day? I don't know why I don't remember. I shouldn't have just said I didn't remember what I didn't have class. But anyway, so I went, you know, early in the morning, maybe around 9 a.m. But mm-hmm. there were some people that had agreed to get there at 7 a.m. So I went early in the morning, and we were trying to watch the hearing, also communicating what was happening about the hearing via Defend Wisconsin. So Defend Wisconsin, both on Twitter, and we later set up a Facebook group page for Defend Wisconsin, but we also had the TAA's account on Twitter and Facebook, which we didn't have a lot of followers at that point. Right now, the TAA Facebook page has approximately a little over 2,000 likes, and then the TAA on Twitter has around a little over 1,000 followers. Defend Wisconsin has more, you know, it's kind of as a brand a little bit more all-encompassing than the TAA, mm-hmm. You know, so putting out information about what was happening, what was going on in the hearing through those channels. The Defend Wisconsin website itself was pretty rudimentary at that point, and I went into all of this not having a background in web design and learned a lot of web updating, how to use WordPress, which is a pretty user-friendly program, but they're both the TAA website and Defend Wisconsin website are both WordPress sites, so it functions a lot like a Word document, but there's definitely a learning curve for me personally about how to use those technologies. You know, I had been on Twitter before, but never used it a whole lot, and so I learned a lot of that very quickly as well. So things shifted very quickly on Tuesday the 15th. Do you want me to talk more about that day?
Yeah, let's talk about that day.
Okay. Well, we certainly didn't set out to occupy the Capitol. I think that there had been maybe murmurings of that idea the day before, but I personally was a skeptic. I dismissed that idea and was continually surprised throughout what became the occupation of the State House. So the idea that day, or the tactic that day, was to pack the public hearing. You know, we're going to pack the public hearing. And that was what our stated goal was, to pack the public hearing, to get it to go as long as possible, and show that there was this outpouring of opposition and concern about this bill. So unions from around the state were busing their members into the state capitol to testify. So you had a lot of teachers, nurses. So the testimony went on all day. I ended up testifying at about probably 2:30 in the morning on the 16th, what was then the 16th. I don't think that the legislators, probably the Democrats or the Republicans, anticipated what a huge response there would be. The testimony went from, well, the hearing probably started at 8 a.m., and then the official hearing, the Republicans cut off testimony at the official hearing at like 3 a.m. on the 16th, so that entire day. And then there was a point, which I guess I'll talk about, the evening of the 15th, I remember being up on the fourth, the hearing was going on the fourth floor of the Capitol in one of their hearing rooms, and we were getting word at about, in the evening, around, I want to say around 9 p.m., that the Republicans were going to cut off testimony, that they were going to cut off testimony to that evening, and so we had to respond very quickly. Again, this is that kind of triage and dealing as things come up. And the Capitol had emptied out a lot. There had been, I want to say maybe there were like, estimates might have been around 15,000 people there during the day, but it had significantly thinned, obviously, by evening. But there were a lot of TAA people left, some undergraduate students, and others that were continuing to testify. You know, particularly if you would have come in from out of town, you know, you'd be waiting all day to testify. And they had probably hundreds of people left that had turned in slips. And, you know, you fill out a registration slip, and then you turn it in, and you can either register your opposition, or you can register or support, or you can either register to speak or register just for or against. And by and large, everyone was registering in opposition and to speak in opposition. But whether or not those people were still there, you know, if you registered in the morning and it's 9 p.m. at night, I don't know if people are still going to physically be there to speak. But there were a lot of people that hadn't spoken and hadn't given testimony. And I hadn't actually at that point either. But a group of mostly TAA members were standing, ended up, you know, went to the front of the door of the public hearing room and were chanting, "Let us speak, let us speak, let us speak." And this is probably one of the things that stays with me the most, is just hearing people chanting, "Let us speak, let us speak, let us speak." It was a tense moment. And what I was doing with a couple other TAA members is we were sitting in the hallway around the corner with one laptop that we were, you know, had on the guest wireless network at the Capitol, looking up phone numbers for television stations and calling reporters. And I remember calling the student papers. And right now, I don't remember if it was the Badger Herald or if it was the Daily Cardinal. We called both of them. And they were so excited. The student reporters are like, "Really? That's what's going on? We're coming right now," you know? And I just think, like, oh, as a young, you know, undergraduate journalist, like, it's going to be like the most exciting thing that's ever happened in your young journalistic career. So, you know, I think we had given them our cell phone numbers, and they were like, "Is it still going on? Is it over here? We're coming right now." You know, they were like rushing up State Street to get to the Capitol. And yeah, that was pretty cute. Like that was exciting for them, I think. And so we were desperately calling all of the media outlets, because at that point, you know, they had pretty much done their story for the day, right? But it was still before the 10 p.m. news. So it was like, it was a moment where we could tactically try to get on the news at 10, right? And so still try to get it in. So we were focusing on, you know, we made sure that we called the student papers, but we were, you know, focusing also on trying to get television and get television cameras there. There was one reporter who was there the day of the public hearing from the Chronicle of Higher Education. And that reporter, he ended up doing a pretty sympathetic piece in the Chronicle of Higher Ed. So he was there. But at that moment, when people were in that hallway chanting, "Let us speak, let us speak, let us speak," there were not very many reporters there. We ended up, I think, you know, we got back on the news and we talked to several reporters that, you know, were in the Capitol area. And so that was what I was doing in that moment. And so that moment was tense. And then Lena Taylor, who's one of the Democratic senators, came out and she stood on a chair and she spoke, or kind of acted as a mediator between the Republican chairs of the Joint Finance Committee and us, the demonstrators. And what they agreed to do was that they would continue the testimony until 3 a.m., and then the Republicans cut off the testimony, and the Democrats ended up reconvening testimony shortly thereafter, and the testimony continued through the night. And so what we did was there's a clause, I guess, in Department of Administration regulations about the Capitol, that if there's ongoing testimony, if there's ongoing testimony, the building stays open. And so this was already, you know, 9:30 p.m. Normally, the building hours for the state capitol are 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. But because the public hearing was ongoing, you know, the building was still open. And so this was a decision, I guess, made by whoever was there from the part of the Capitol Police that evening. You know, so there's kind of that interplay between what we as demonstrators were doing and then the response from the officials from Department of Administration and the Capitol Police is, and then so the official hearing ended then at 3 a.m. on the 16th, and the Democrats reconvened an informal public hearing shortly thereafter. And then that was interpreted by Capitol Police, whoever in Department of Administration would have been making decisions at that moment, that would mean the building stayed open, because that would qualify as a public hearing and keeping the building open, which is a key point for what, you know, became the occupation of the Capitol during that couple-week period. Since the building was open, people could come and go. I came back into the Capitol that evening with sleeping bags and pillows and walked past the Capitol Police. I mean, I was convinced that they would stop me, you know, but they didn't. Yeah. Of course, later they started restricting what you could bring in the Capitol, but at that point people were carrying, and, you know, so we set up a Facebook page, and some of the undergraduates were pushing on Facebook this, like, come sleep with your TA, come to the Capitol and sleep with your TA, and we put up Facebook ads, like, sleep over in the Capitol, you know, and so a lot of the people that were there, I would say the majority of people that were there that first night, and even the first couple days before it started to get really big, were TA members and graduate students, and undergraduate students, you know, because it was, like, fun, you know, like, oh, I'm gonna take my sleeping bag and my blanket and pillow and I'm gonna go sleep at the Capitol, like, awesome. So it was really that alliances that we were able to build, or pre-existing alliances with undergraduate students in particular, that helped get bodies into the Capitol, mm-hmm. and people to continue to testify all night until the next day. And, you know, that hearing ended up going on for at least 60 hours. You know, it continued for over a week, and the Democrats kept hearing testimony. And that was a decision on part, you know, to interpret that as meaning the building stayed open was a key decision on the part of state officials, you know, that allowed the Capitol occupation to happen. Mm-hmm.
All right. So Tuesday and Wednesday are sort of like one big long day, and maybe even part of Thursday. But are there events that stick out that break that for you?
That's a good question. I remember going and teaching Wednesday morning on very little sleep. You know, I actually slept at home that night because I had to teach the next day. But I remember going home at probably 3:30 in the morning. And at that point, I lived about two blocks from the Capitol. So I lived very close. But I remember being at the Capitol until probably 3 or 3:30 in the morning. And then, you know, I had to teach at 9:30 the next day. So going home and sleeping for probably 3 hours and getting up and teaching on adrenaline alone, probably. You know, so I remember, you know, working the next day and then rushing back to the Capitol. There was a room 300 Northeast, and it's a hearing room in the Capitol. And it was originally reserved by the AFT, American Federation of Teachers of Wisconsin, which is the parent union of which the TAA were a local affiliated with the AFT Wisconsin. And so they had reserved this hearing room. And I remember sitting in the room on the Tuesday, on the day of the public hearing, and was like, oh, we're going to go have a meeting. You know, somebody, one of the TAA staff people said to me, we're going to go have a meeting in 300, you know, I think I misheard the room, so it took me a long time to find it. We're going to go have a meeting about what to do, about tactic, and you should come. And so I went to the room 300 Northeast, and it was a few handful of people from AFT. There was an older woman who was a board member for AFT Wisconsin who was sitting there, myself and a few other TAA members, but essentially the room was empty. And, you know, we basically took the room over. It became our, some people refer to it as a war room, but like strategy room. You know, essentially the TAA ended up taking over this room the first week. And having a space in the Capitol that we were organizing out of was also critical. To tell people to come to that room. We ended up setting up this huge, like, kitchen assemblage right outside. I mean, it was pretty impressive. Somebody brought in a full-size coat rack that was in the hallway. There were Bunsen burners and, like, other kinds of cooking implements and tables of food. and somebody dropped off American flags for us, and so we tried to figure out how to hang them up, and we had little American flags on, like, sitting in our TAA cups, because we were getting all, we were, and so it became a place where people went. But I remember being there on the 15th in this room that was empty, you know, and within a couple days, it just was this hub of activity and central focal point. Reporters were coming by, like, AP, BBC, like a big name, like AP, BBC, New York Times. Like, I didn't ever talk to anybody from Al Jazeera, but I know that Al Jazeera came, you know, sent reporters and CNN. You know, so it became. So I think having that space, that room in the Capitol, was very important for us as an organization to coordinate our activities and a central focal point. And also because we had, you know, so then we were also seen as in the leadership or in this position of leadership because we had a space and we had a central coordinating effort inside the Capitol. That second weekend of the demonstrations, we had a membership meeting at the Concourse Hotel, which is a few blocks away from the Capitol. And it was the first time I walked in there and saw that there was this entire parallel organizing effort of all of the bigger unions, like SEIU, AFL-CIO, all of these other unions that was going on in the Concourse Hotel. But I think that we were in a position where we were getting a lot of attention by nature of that we were in the Capitol, that we had this space, coordinating space there. So we were getting a lot of reporters, people. So we used the TAA, Twitter, and Facebook, but more primarily Defend Wisconsin. I feel like it kind of became the voice of the Capitol occupation, and to request supplies and say, you know, we need donations of water and food, and then it would appear, you know, like the morning of the public hearing on the 17th, there was a sit-in in front of the chambers, the Senate chambers. This was before we learned that the Democrats had fled the state. You know, so that hearing was supposed to start at 11 a.m. and there was a undergraduate student organized walkout that I think that they met at 10 a.m. on Library Mall, and then they marched up to the Capitol. And it wasn't until later that we learned that the Democrats had left the state. So students and others were sitting in front of the Senate chamber. So I remember putting out a tweet, something like, we need water supplies, or, you know, we needed to be able to put food and water to the people that were sitting in, right? And then people started bringing us donations. It was pretty cool, actually. But that was one very important way that we were using social media, was to, one, get out information, but also ask for supplies. Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned the Wisconsin 14. Do you have specific memories of when you found out that they had left the Capitol and had fled the state?
Let's see. So that would have been Thursday the 17th. It must have been, I want to say it must have been in the early afternoon on Thursday, because I have a radio show. I had a radio show, I should say, Thursday mornings. What time was our show at? I think, it's bad that I don't remember. I think 11 to noon. And so we did the radio show on WSUM, and we had various students and also a couple faculty members that were participating in the march call in. And we had a woman call in from her car and say, there are high school students, there are students marching up West Washington Avenue, you know, and we got a report from somebody from their car that was listening to our show. So then I rushed back to the Capitol after that. So I want to say that it was early afternoon on the 17th when we got kind of official word, because there was a sit-in going on and the hearing was stalled. And then, because I remember I was sitting at the table. There was a large table or setup of tables in that room that I mentioned, 300 Northeast. So I remember that I was sitting at the table and I was on a computer doing social media. And, you know, I think somebody rushed in to say, you know, the Democrats have left the state. Or, you know, I just remember sitting at the table and, you know, we were doing social media, asking for various supplies, and must have tweeted something then about how the Democrats had left the state. And I remember being shocked, very shocked. And it was a very weird experience, too, to be sitting in this room on the third floor of the Capitol, a very official, you know, the State House, and being sitting at this table doing media work, and you look behind you and look out the very stately windows, and you see that there's 30,000 people marching around outside. It was a crazy experience to feel like we were in this role of course we weren't coordinating per se. There are all these other influences and other unions, but to be in this role of being in the middle and the hub of organizing and the responsibility that comes with that when you are putting out information to make sure that it's verified, you know. And so I think that's one thing that helped us with Defend Wisconsin to be successful, was that most of us that were running are communication students. So with Twitter, you have interesting dynamics where it's a great tool to get out information to people quickly, but it can also be a rumor mill and spread misinformation equally as quickly as you can spread factual, true information. But so coming from a communications and journalistic background, I think it helped us, you know, we were always very careful to try to verify information and put out information that we could verify was true. You know, it's hard when things are shifting and happening very quickly, but that helped build a reputation for Defend Wisconsin that otherwise we perhaps might not have had. But to be careful to take that responsibility very seriously when you are seen as in a leadership role in something like a mass protest.
Mm-hmm. Was there an event, whether it was Wisconsin 14 or something else, that at least signified in your mind that this thing changed between whatever it was initially to a more long-term, multi-week event?
That's a good question. Well, as I think the Fab 14, as the Democratic senators have become known as, that in some ways it's kind of all bets of our original strategy were off, in a sense. The original strategy being trying to get some Republicans to vote no. So kind of simultaneous strategy of trying to convince Republicans, a key number of Republicans in the Senate, being 3, to vote no, but also then simultaneously trying to stall so that we could have our voices heard. So that definitely shifted the tactics, and it's kind of this, things are getting kind of crazy, and we're like, imagine what was going to happen, you know, and you have 30,000 people outside marching around, and the Democrats have gone to Illinois, and it's like, oh my God, what if we started? You know, what's going on? just this sense of unknown. And I should mention at that point, the TAA on, I have some notes here, so.
Sure. Like,
you know, the TAA, you know, organized several teach-outs, what we called teach-outs. And we were very strategic to call them teach-outs, not a strike. We don't legally have the right to strike, number one. And number two, you know, we recognize that our target was not the university. We, you know, it's not us versus the university, which was, I think, for some people in the TAA, a little bit of a mentality shift, because the TAA, throughout its history, has always been kind of oppositional with the university administration. You know, we negotiate our contract with the university administration and, you know, other kinds of things that the TAA pushes for, you know, more affordable public education, democracy in higher ed, are things that often pit the TAA against university administration. But in this case, it was very clear that the target was Scott Walker and the Republicans in the legislature at the Capitol, not the university administration. Of course, there's everything that was going on with the New Badger partnership at the same time. So, you know, as the spring went on, that shifted. But in that moment, you know, our target was Scott Walker and was the Republicans. And so we put out a press release, we put out a series of press releases. We put out one on Wednesday, February 16th, with the title, "Let's Stop Activity on Campus Tomorrow." You know, reading, "The Teaching Assistants Association is strongly calling for a teach out tomorrow. This means we are calling for all activity to cease on campus in response to the threat that the budget repair bill poses to graduate employees, the university community, and workers across the state. We are not calling for the canceling of classes since we value the role of the UW as an institution of learning. Instead, we are calling to hold campus classes off campus." And it goes on. But one of the things that I think myself and others that were doing media for the TA did was help frame that message in a way that we are very clear, or trying to communicate very clearly, that the target is the state government. It's not the university. And the teach outs was a very delicate thing because we wanted to take action. This was also somewhat in solidarity with the school teachers, first being Madison Teachers Incorporated, the union that represents teachers in the Madison School District. And then I think up at a certain point, there were up to like a dozen schools around campus. This would have been the 17th. Schools in Madison, Minona Grove, Verona, Oregon, Middleton, Wanakee, DeForest, Oshkosh, and then even Milwaukee. The entire Milwaukee Public School District was closed for at least one day. So we were doing, you know, so every we were taking action kind of not directly coordinated with what the K-12 public school teachers were doing, but in solidarity with them, but wanting to frame our message very clearly that our target is the state government, that we it's not us versus the university, that we want our members, the teaching assistants, to continue instruction, provide alternative assignments, or to, you know, if possible, meet with their students off of campus, that we don't want learning to stop. But this bill is so urgent, and it's so important that we're asking people to do this, to take action. And so, you know, it was negotiating that was at times a little bit difficult. The reason I say that is because, you know, we had a series of general membership meetings. So those decisions were made in meetings of the full membership, or everybody from the membership that wanted to come. And there were, you know, in those meetings, a couple hundred people maybe. We had several in hearing rooms in the Capitol, in a hearing room that would be packed. So we made those decisions with a large number of people. But part of the tensions between like doing publicity or doing media for an organization like the TAA is making those decisions can take time. And that's important because you need to have buy-in from your members and you want to have a democratic process. But it's hard when you need to communicate that message externally to campus, to the professors that you work for, to, you know, university administration, to the media, and a channel to do that is through the media. And so when meetings were dragging on into the evening, like we're talking on Thursday about whether or not to cancel campus, you know, and it's, you know, 7, 8, 9 p.m. one day, and we're talking about whether or not we want our members to not go to work the next day, that it causes sometimes issues, right, about being able to communicate a coherent message and work within that institutional process, organizational process.
Mm-hmm. A couple more things for this time, and so I want to try to keep it into this early few days.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to ask it this way, now that you've, you know, been able to reflect about this a bit. What sort of things were you learning about, you know, both yourself organizing politics with a big P in these first few days?
I think about myself, I learned that I was capable of staying awake and working more than I would have ever thought possible. And so rising to the occasion myself, but also seeing others around me do the same thing. is something that was really gratifying, that organizationally, the TAA, we were able to do what we did because the TAA existed before. But the TAA organization that existed prior couldn't necessarily, you know, wasn't, as I said earlier, wasn't designed with this kind of mass scale protest and occupation in mind. And so being able to work in the moment and navigate and kind of adapt those structures to fit what needed to be done in that moment is something that I'm proud that we were able to do. And there were certainly tensions and around that, but kind of creating structures that worked for then versus, and but also working within the pre-existing structure. So I'll give you an example. So I was one of the people primarily responsible for writing press releases and sending out press releases and, you know, communicating that, our messaging externally. And so what we ended up doing, and this was completely developed on the fly the first week and into the second week of the Capitol occupation, was, you know, we agreed, so it was my friend Magda and I that were primarily, and then a couple other people, but we're primarily writing press releases, is working with the two co-presidents, Kevin Gibbons and Alex Hanna, and, you know, we don't have time to have an entire committee sign off on a press release, but we're going to draft something, and the two of them are going to read it, and we're going to harass them until they do, because media never seems important, but, like, you have to do this right now, you know, read this and get quotes from them, and we're going to just get the two of them to sign off on it, and we're going to send it out. You know, like, streamlining processes is something that we were able to do. And for the most part, I think that it was fairly effective. But again, that isn't how the TAA would function in normal times, but an example of how we were able to adapt to the ever-shifting circumstances of the Capitol occupation.
Okay. And one more question I have, and again, this is in these early days, is a couple other people that I've interviewed specifically talked about the weekend being a time of rest because others would come in and sort of pick up the slack. So I don't know if you want to talk about the first weekend, what your memories of that are. Was it a time that you were able to perhaps get some rest, or was it still part of one long continuum for you?
I would say it was more of a long continuum. I mentioned earlier in this interview that I ended up getting physically sick, but that was in end of the second week. So that first weekend, I remember that we had a general membership meeting. I'm just thinking of what day is it? That Sunday. We had a general membership meeting that Sunday evening at the Concourse Hotel, and I alluded to that already. So we had a membership meeting at the Concourse Hotel. So I remember that standing out from that first weekend. It all runs together, you know. So that, you know, there was the day of the public hearing, the day that the Democrats fled the state, you know, and that was the period where we had several teach outs. Like, we had one Thursday, the day of the public hearing, and then I remember going to class teaching on that Friday. So we ended up deciding not to have a teach out Friday, and then we had two more teach outs the following Monday and Tuesday. So I think that that's, you know what, I think I actually might be wrong. I would maybe have to go back and look at my notes, but I remember seeing my students one day. Actually, I think, no. We had teach outs. It was Thursday and Friday, but I remember Friday, the class that I taught, they had an out of class work day, so, or something, so that I didn't technically teach that day. And then I think I saw them on Monday. Oh, we were supposed to have individual conferences that Friday, but I canceled. So my students, they write multiple drafts of papers. And so that was the day that I was supposed to have draft conferences with them. And I had some scheduled for the next Monday and Tuesday already. And so I remember what I did was I didn't have time to grade during this first week. You know, I'm very proud that I did my job, and that a very important part of all of this protesting was continuing to do my job and maintaining good relationships with my department, and that meant doing my job. But that said, I did not have time to grade my students' drafts that first week, and so I had let them know that I needed to reschedule the conferences I would have had with them and other teaching assistants in my department. There's five of us that taught that class, met with their students off of campus that Friday. So we had teach-outs Thursday the 17th and Friday the 18th. And then I remember we had a meeting at the concourse on Sunday. Saturday just all runs together. That might have been the day. I think that was the day of the Tea Party counter rally, which was very small. So that day there was a Tea Party counter rally. And then Sunday we had a meeting at the concourse. Monday we did not have a teach out. I remember being one of the people that was advocating for, like, I want to see my students. I feel like it's important to have class. It's important to be able to see our students face to face and explain what's going on. So we had class on Monday, and then we had our last teach out on that Tuesday. And I met with my students off of campus to finish their student conferences with their drafts. And the ones that I needed to meet off campus were all very accommodating. We just met at a coffee shop, the Espresso Royale, right near campus. And so you asked me about whether or not there was a time of rest, and I would say no. Definitely not. And maybe that's by nature of what my role was. You know, doing media work continually needed to get done. So there were a group of, I want to say, one, two, three, like maybe like five of us that started and kind of stayed with it. And then as we continued with the website, Defend Wisconsin, we recruited. And so people were constantly coming into that room, 300 Northeast, wanting to help, especially as things got big and as the story grew nationally, internationally, you know, it became the thing to do, right? That was this interesting kind of shift where you went from this small protest to a critical mass. So rather than the norm being on the sideline, there was a moment in that period in February and March where the normal thing to do became to participate in the protest. And that was definitely a paradigm shift. But like the normal thing that myself and my friends did on a Saturday was we went to a demonstration. Like I would say until mid-March, like when spring break came around in the second half of March, and it felt weird not to go to a demonstration on a Saturday. It was like the thing that you did on a Saturday is you went and you demonstrated. It became the new normal for a period of time. So I would say I didn't really get very much rest until my body gave out on me and I physically got sick.
Okay. Again, it's me. I need to wrap this up for today. But I do, I mean, you have notes here. We're going to meet again. I think what I may try to do too is before we meet again, if you have time, I'll at least give you access to this recording. Because it might not hurt to listen to it before we meet again, just in case there's things you need to clarify. And you can have your own words to sort of hear how that went. So is there anything, again, that's on your mind now that you might be fearful if we don't say now, we may not get on the record the next time?
I guess I'll just come back to briefly, I feel like it's really important that we were able, that we tried to strategize and actively frame ourselves and what we were doing, and articulate why we are here, why we were at the Capitol, and what it was about. That it was about democracy and it was about workers' rights and about what the deeper themes were. And particularly for us as graduate students, I think it was important because we're in this situation where, you know, I think I might have mentioned this the last time, you know, we can be framed one of two major ways. You can frame somebody that's a graduate student as somebody who's never worked a day in their life and they're just your overprivileged kid, in this extended adolescence. Or you can frame us as we're workers, and we're living off of our salaries, and many of us have families, and we have financial obligations, and we're also students on top of that. So you can either kind of look at like lazy, not really working, or hardworking and industrious. There's kind of these two main frames that can work with a graduate student. And so one of the things that we were up against with the capital occupation is wanting to frame ourselves as also as working people, but also as students. And, I think that there are statistics to back that up. For example, over 85% of discussion sections on campus are taught by teaching assistants. And, if you add in discussion sections, lectures, and labs, graduate assistants do almost half of the instruction on campus. So that's a huge amount of the teaching that's going on this campus is done by graduate student labor. But those are the kinds of things that are nuanced that we have to actively bring up. We have to actively present ourselves that way, particularly in a situation where we're occupying a state house. The maybe more conservative media outlets can say, oh, they're just a bunch of kids that don't have anything better to do. But so we kind of run that risk, and that it was very important as an organization and for the movement to present a different side of why we were doing what we were doing.
Okay. Well, Jill, I want to thank you very much for your time today. All right. Today is, what is today? Today is the 28th of November, 2011. This is the third interview with Jill Hopke. We're here in the conference room in Steenbach Library on the campus of UW-Madison. I'm Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program, and we are doing this interview for our Capitol Protest 2011 Oral History Project. All right, Jill, thanks for coming. My first question is, we've talked a lot about chronology in our last interview, some of the key events and when they happened. And I know when we left off and turned off the recorder that one of the sort of last chronological events that you wanted to talk about, at least in terms of a specific event that happened on a specific day, was the Senate vote. So I think we'll start with that.
Sure. That was one of the more, there were a lot of memorable moments during the Capitol protests. Something was always happening and the days were very long. But the entire time until that day, I thought we would win, and by win, I mean I thought that we would stop the budget repair bill, which is now known as Wisconsin Act 10, from passing. I was perhaps a little overly idealistic, but maybe in a sense I had to believe that in order to be able to continue and work so hard and put in so many hours. But I really did think that we would defeat it, that with such a mass outpouring of public opposition, both about the content of the bill, but also about the process. And it was kind of an affront to democracy. It really was an attack on the democratic system. And that by making our voices heard, I thought that we would be able to stop the bill. And so that day, which was March 10th, yes, March 10th, the day that the Republicans voted on the bill, it shattered my faith in democratic process in many ways. That was a day that we knew something would happen, and I think that we need to remember that there was a context of in the weeks, in the nearly a month leading up to that moment, there had been a tremendous amount of buildup. And so people were primed to take action and highly emotionally invested in the outcome of the bill. And of course, you know, as things dragged on, we knew that it would have to conclude somehow. You know, it wasn't that the Fab 14, the 14 Democratic senators were going to stay in Illinois forever. I mean, there was going to be some kind of outcome or resolution. And I remember that, and I was following it closely because I was doing media work with the TAA and our website and Twitter account, Defend Wisconsin. And I remember that morning that there were some kind of leaked news on Madison.com, the local news website for the local newspapers, that indicated that there were some back dealings that looked like there might be compromise, that perhaps some of the Republicans were talking to some of the Democrats. And so things were looking a little bit like they might be coming to some kind of conclusion. You know, I thought optimistically that perhaps the collective bargaining provisions would be taken out of the bill. And so, you know, I remember that evening, probably about 5:30, I was having dinner with a friend, and we were actually scheduled to go to a TAA executive board meeting that would have started at 6 p.m., and we both got text messages from a friend of ours saying they were going to split the bill, and they were going to vote on the bill. And it was a little confusing at first what that meant exactly. And so I called our friend Abian up and asked him, what's going on? What does this mean? This text message that you just sent?" And he explained that they were going to split off. You know, what had kept the Republicans, even though they had a majority in the Senate, from voting was that because there were fiscal provisions in the bill, they needed to have 20 senators present to vote. However, there were only 19 Republicans. So when all of the Senate Democrats fled the state, it deprived the Republicans of the one person necessary for the quorum required to vote on a bill that contained fiscal provisions. And so it is kind of surprising that the Republicans didn't actually pull this move sooner than they did. But so then what happened was what they ended up doing, rather than working out a compromise that might have been acceptable to the Democrats and to members of the public that were protesting, they simply, you know, all along Walker and the Republicans had said that the bill was about money, that the state had this tremendous fiscal crisis for the biennium, and that the action was driven by a budget crisis, and that it was about money. But this is when it became extremely apparent, as it, I guess, to most of us already was, but that it wasn't about money, that it was about stripping away fundamental rights to collectively bargain. Because what they ended up doing, you know, even though they had claimed all along it was a fiscal bill, they split off the fiscal provisions, which enabled the Senate, the Republicans alone, to vote without that necessary extra member, one of the Democrats. So they were able to vote on the non-fiscal provisions of the supposedly fiscally driven bill without 20 members present. And so there was a lot of fallout afterwards about, of course, the public notice and whether or not there was adequate amount of public notice for this meeting. But so when we heard, it was probably about 5:30, and they were scheduled to vote at 6 p.m. And I was at the campus end of State Street with a friend, and we immediately gathered up our things and started rushing towards the walking up towards the Capitol. And it's about a mile, you know, between campus and the Capitol. And I remember, you know, and this is early March, the 10th of March, we're walking up State Street, and I remember the mood of the moment. There, as we were getting up towards the Capitol, a couple of bikers biked past us yelling about the bill. They're going to vote on the bill. They're going to vote on the bill. Get to the Capitol. Get to the Capitol. And as we got up to the State Street side of the Capitol, there was a huge, you know, this was early March, so it was lots of snow. There was a huge mound of snow on the intersection, on the State Street intersection with the Capitol Square. And there was a guy standing on top of the snow pile. Like, so snow pile is probably definitely taller than I am. So at least maybe 6 or 6.5 feet tall. You know, a guy was standing on top of the snow pile yelling about the bill, kind of like Paul Revere, you know, like a town crier, just yelling, "Get to the Capitol now! Everybody get to the Capitol! They're going to vote on the bill! They're going to vote on the bill!" And it was this terrible but yet amazing moment to see the community and our state and even the nation paying attention, you know, just so engaged. And as I said before, it was in the context of just expectation that something would happen. And also it's important to note that in that last, I want to say, week and a half, roughly the last week from when the official occupation ended to this day, the Department of Administration had really clamped down on public access to the Capitol and really restricted access to the Capitol. And so there was only one door of the Capitol open, and it was on the King Street side, so on the opposite side from State Street. So, you know, we had to rush around to the other side, and we got there a little before 6 p.m., and there was a long single-file line that went out to the edge of the street on the Capitol Square. So we got in line, and everybody's, you know, emotions are high, because we know the people, the hundreds of, or so of us that are waiting in line, know that the vote's going to happen, but in order to get into the Capitol, we have to wait in line, and it was very orderly. And my friend Jay and I were able to get into the Capitol right a little bit before 6 p.m. when the vote was scheduled to happen. So, you know, we went through the single file line, and then getting in the Capitol, at that point they had metal detectors set up. So we had to get through metal detectors, have a pat down, you know, put all of our things from our pockets into trays and have them examined. So it took time to get into the Capitol, and it was a single file line. There were already, I would say, several hundred or so people inside when we got there. But it wasn't as though you could just walk in. There was that the Department of Administration had been, as I said, limiting access. And that was something also, to get back to what I was talking about a little bit last time, the importance of social media, and particularly of Defend Wisconsin, the Twitter account that we've been running, that was particularly important in that period when the Department of Administration was limiting access to the Capitol, because there was a real dearth of information of, and the Department of Administration officials were always changing what their procedures were, what you could bring into the Capitol, what doors were open, you know, if there was a special door for media or for handicapped individuals, what items were prohibited. So the rules were on a daily basis changing, and there were so many people that wanted to get in the Capitol, like, or if you could get a special pass, if you were going to go to a legislative aid office. And so our account, Defend Wisconsin, was particularly important in getting information about that out, including on this day. I wasn't in the Capitol before, but one of the other volunteers with the TAA sent out a tweet, you know, saying, I should probably have the text here, actually. I can read it to you. What I would call, on this issue, the most important Twitter message of the year that read, "Emergency, Republican senators to split budget repair bill and vote on the union killing things tonight. Everybody to the Capitol now," and then the hashtag WIUnion. And that was retweeted more than 100 times. So it helped get the message out. And I sent a text message on to a number of people, and so some friends joined me. And that was the only day when things felt particularly tense to me, you know, being outside of that Senate chamber right at 6 p.m. with several hundred other people chanting, shame, shame, you know, as we knew they were voting, and apparently they had allowed a few, like 20 members of the public into the actual chamber to supposedly say that it was open to the public, though there were hundreds of us in the building but outside of the chamber, and knowing that that vote was taking place in spite of all the opposition. And it was an emotional moment, and it was an emotional night to be in the Capitol. But again, I think that what we were able to do collectively as the TAA was very important in helping get out information about what was going on, and being a presence in the Capitol was very important. And of course, the Republicans voted. There was one no vote. Dale Schultz did vote no on the bill, but almost unanimously, you know, they passed the bill. It went to the assembly the next morning and was very quickly, a few days later, signed by Governor Walker.
Well, thank you for that. I guess I know you have a list there of things. You gave a presentation this summer, and so you sort of, you know, had to sort of put this into words, or at least sort of topics, to be able to get on the record. And as I said, I think you've answered to a certain extent most of the questions that I wanted to ask. Although I think the next question you haven't addressed directly, and that's, do you believe the media, and I guess I would use the term mainstream media, accurately represented the protests?
I was surprised, actually, by the coverage. I've talked to various people that have had difference of opinion from me, and this is completely anecdotal. I haven't analyzed the coverage myself. But I do feel that overall the coverage was relatively positive, more positive than I would have expected. To kind of backtrack to when Governor Walker first announced the bill in mid-February, that first weekend, you know, he made the comments about the National Guard, and that first weekend the coverage was very positive, and towards Governor Walker's position, and framed, it was positive towards his position, and it was framed around the idea of the budget deficit and fiscal crisis. So the message that Governor Walker and the Republicans were trying to put out was the mainstream media narrative. But then I felt that there was a shift when we, you know, students, the TAA and undergraduate students held a march on February 14th, the following Monday. And as I talked about last time, more in detail, you know, using the imagery of hearts and love and talking about education and you know, hands off our teachers, which is the slogan that the undergraduates were putting forth. I think that really did help start to shift the tone to a more pro-worker perspective. And so on the 15th, the day that there was the public hearing, above the fold, the front cover picture on the Wisconsin State Journal, one of the major papers in the state, what was a picture of our demonstration and of some of the graduate students holding up our I Heart UW, Walker Don't Break My Heart Valentines. So I do think that the message shifted quite significantly, you know, in those first days when the mass protests started happening that week. And I think that we were fairly successful at getting our message out as a TAA, because there were a number of us that are communication students that were pushing the organization to think strategically and to be actively trying to frame the message. And because we were situated for the bulk of the protests having a base in the Capitol and a place where reporters were coming. And so I think that helped us, for the small part that we were doing, shift that message and focus on what we saw as the key themes about workers' rights, about democracy, importance of education and public sector, and so on. So I do think that period then, from our first march until, I feel like, again, you know, Governor Walker, he pushed back his budget address, and he actually held it on, I believe it was March 1st. No, it actually might have, I think it was after March 1st. I think he was originally supposed to hold it on March 1st, and he ended up holding it later. I would have to go back and check the exact date. But I feel like between mid-February until when he gave his budget address, the coverage was very positive towards the public sector worker protest against the budget repair bill side of things. I feel like Walker got fairly positive coverage then when he gave that budget address. But I think that there overall was a shift that we even are still seeing today, because rather than taking as the kind of standard narrative, media narrative, being pro-walker and kind of the pro-business side, but you even now will see things like controversial action, controversial bill inserted when talking about the Republicans and when talking about Walker. So the narrative has shifted, kind of the standard narrative has shifted somewhat, I guess for lack of a better term, I might say towards the left, but I don't think that it's really a matter of being towards left or right, but towards questioning the anti-democratic moves that the Republicans and Walker have been pushing through. You know, budget repair bill was the first time that we really saw this, but there have been numerous bills that have been passed afterwards. For example, the voter ID bill that has very significantly changed the requirements for voting here in Wisconsin is another one. So I feel like when you see Governor Walker mentioned and you see the Republicans' legislation mentioned, you'll see more of a questioning narrative. So I think overall it's been relatively positive.
Thank you. All right. So as far as my questions about the actual protests themselves, that is all I have. So the questions I have now are sort of post-protest. So I don't know if you want to, at this point, if there's anything else on your mind specifically about the protests, or if we want to wait and sort of maybe try to hit that at the end of this session.
Not at this time,
I guess. All right, so let's move on, and I want to talk about, again, some of the events that have happened. Get your personal take on some events that have happened post-protests. And one sort of, I think, can be tied to the protest, or at least around the same time, and that's the Kloppenburg Supreme Court election. So my specific question to you is, were you involved in that in any way? And whether, if so or if not, what your thoughts were about that election?
I helped a little bit. I phone banked a few times from the TAA office for the Kloppenburg campaign. I had talked last time about how we had run the TAA office, not myself personally, but the organization had run the TAA office as a phone bank center during the protests in February and March, but also continuing through the April spring elections and the Supreme Court election. And so I did do that a few times. I wasn't as active on that campaign, and there were a number of other issues going on in the spring related to the TAA that I was working on. Most notably, former Chancellor Biddy Martin's proposal for a new Badger partnership that would have split the UW-Madison off from the rest of the UW system and created it as a public authority model. So that was a concurrent issue that was taking a lot of the TAA's attention also in the spring, along with the election.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I didn't have that written down on our first draft of notes a colleague and I created. So I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind talking in a bit more detail, because it is an event that happened concurrently to the Capitol protests and could have and still does, I think, affect our campus today. So you want to talk a little bit more about the New Badger Partnership?
Sure. It was a less clear-cut issue. The TAA came out in opposition to the New Badger Partnership, and I think that we struggled, though, with what's the alternative. There's always a tension between promoting your ideals for the sake of something being your ideal, affordable public education, which I believe very strongly in, and the TAA does as an organization, hold that as a principle to promote public education at its core. But then on the flip side, struggling with the financial realities of the university system and the cuts to the university that had been announced in the spring, and we've even seen additional cuts be announced in the fall, and the reality of how you deal with those cuts. So on the New Badger Partnership issue, the organization took a stance against it and organized pretty strongly and vocally in opposition to former Chancellor Martin. Though on that issue, there was a lot more contention, I guess I would say, within the organization it's a complicated issue. You know, I had a radio show last spring and produced a show about New Measure Partnership and read through quite a bit of the material, but still don't even feel like I had the greatest sense of exactly what it would mean. You know, so you can talk about things like flexibilities in purchasing, and you know, the most clear-cut issue being, you know, having separated UW would have separated UW-Madison off from the rest of the system. So I was personally more mixed about it, and I feel that there were a lot of people in the TAA that were. So that was a little bit harder of an issue to negotiate within the organization. And for me, the issue was, well, what can we present or what can we support as a viable alternative? You know, we feel like we should be calling for the chance, you know, that the chancellor should be calling for restoring funding to the university and increasing student financial aid and protections for student financial aid and all of those things. But again, that tension between financial reality and ideal was hard to negotiate on that issue, because I listened to a number of interviews that Biddy Martin had done on the issue, and can really empathize with some of the things that she was saying about the global marketplace for higher education and how we have to compete globally now. But at the same time, I was very strongly opposed to the public authority model part of it and splitting UW-Madison off. But I think some of the other things that were included in the New Badger Partnership and some of the things that did get passed, parts about increasing flexibilities in funding and giving universities in the system block grants as opposed to line items for particular things, are things that I didn't feel that were that alarming, but that's not the position that was held by other people in the TAA. It's a very nuanced issue.
Okay. So as this,
but can I add,
yeah,
actually
please,
add
please,
one thing
please
about
do.
That?
Yes.
You know, but on the New Badger Partnership issue, I do think as the TAA that even though I had some reservations about our position, I guess I would say, I do think that we took the right position to take a stance against the public authority model. And, you know, we saw over the summer that Biddy Martin did leave the university. And so I think that what the TAA did in the spring and trying to push against that, against university administration, what was the right thing to do. We organized a forum where Biddy Martin did come, and trying to educate the campus about what it was, a very difficult issue with lots of different facets that was going on simultaneously with all of the collective bargaining. So, you know, we were trying to educate and advocate on that issue. But that's all.
Okay. So you mentioned summer. As summer rolled around here in Wisconsin, there were recall elections. Both Republican and Democratic senators had recalls against them. So I guess my general question is, how'd you spend your summer? But the sort of subtext is, were you involved in the recalls?
You know, I was not actively involved in the recalls for the senators. I did do some work with Defend Wisconsin, with the website, during Walkerville, in leading up. I was pretty involved up until the budget, until the state budget was passed in June. But quite frankly, I had to spend time on schoolwork. You know, I had to get caught up on other things, and so I didn't spend a lot of time personally on the recall issue. I followed it, and you know, well, it was very encouraging that the Democrats won back two seats, you know, not the necessary three that would have swung the Senate to the Democratic position. And so I can't speak from personal involvement on that issue. I have been a little more involved with the Walker recall. And one of the things that has been hard as this issue is dragged on is, what do you do simply as an organization and as a union to maintain the TAA, to maintain the union itself, versus the political activities that in the long run might get the bill overturned, that will get the bill overturned in the long run, the political process aspects, the recalls, versus signing up new members. So, for example, I was active in the summer with things like preparing for, making a decision about whether or not the TAA was going to try to seek recertification under Wisconsin Act 10. And we ended up deciding not to seek recertification under Wisconsin Act 10 because we feel that it was an unjust standard, and that what we would have gained by seeking recertification, which would have been a very narrow ability to bargain solely on wages, I guess frankly wouldn't have been worth it. And so that was a decision that the TAA made in August. And then fall, there's a lot of turnover every year with new graduate assistants coming to campus, TAs, PAs, and even RAs, which hadn't been covered by our contract in the past. So there's a big orientation membership push that's in the end of August, beginning of September. So there are all of those kinds of things that, well, a membership drive would have gone on anyway, an orientation drive would have gone on anyway, but there was an extra added element of needing to not only try to sign up new members, but also re-sign up old members, because everybody had to sign up again because our dues are not taken out of payroll automatically anymore, and there's no fair share, which is something that if you were covered by the contract, you paid what was called fair share, which was the equivalent of union dues. But the idea being that everybody benefits from the work of the union, and so even if you choose not to join, which is completely somebody's right, you should pay towards services that you get from the union. So Wisconsin Act 10 got rid of fair share, and it also got rid of payroll deductions. So we had to sign up every single member over again, in addition to try to sign up new members. And so there was a tremendous amount of effort that went into that process in the summer and going into the fall. So the time that I spent on TAA activities in the summer and mostly into the fall have been more on those things, though I did help with collecting petition signatures for the Walker recall about 2 weeks ago now when the drive first kicked off.
So there is a question here that you sort of alluded to in your answer about the summer recalls, and that is how did you budget your time during the protests? And I think that can now be sort of moved through just because the protests ended doesn't mean it sounds like your involvement in the political process or the TAA process has. So how do you budget your time between being a student, being a TA, and being an activist?
I have found that difficult to do, and I do think that most people find that difficult. I have been spending less time personally on TA activities starting this fall. I felt that it was important to continue being very active through the membership drive in September. And then the last couple of months, I've been trying to spend less time on TA activities so that I can refocus on my own research and my coursework and my job on campus. I'm actually a research assistant in my department, so I'm not TAing this year, but I'm working for my department. And so trying to spend the majority of my time on those other priorities. I plan to take my preliminary exams in the spring, so I found that I needed to rebalance a little bit. And that's a difficult thing to do because everything that we do in the TAA is very important, particularly now. But at the same time, I came here to get a degree. I came back to school because I wanted to get a PhD, and in the long run, I would like to teach. And so finding that balance is challenging because graduate school is all-encompassing. Research is all-encompassing, and teaching is critical, and the work I do in my department is very important to me. But at the same time, so is what we're doing in the TAA. So I've tried to stay involved with the TAA a little bit, like helping with collecting recall petition signatures and doing some press releases and continuing to do some media work. But I've also, in the last couple months, been trying to hand off some of what had been my responsibilities in the TAA to other individuals.
So I think the last thing I want to ask before we sort of get your final thoughts, or not sort of get your final thoughts, is the Occupy movement. I'm wondering how if you have followed that, and if you have, do you see any correlation between what people are trying to do throughout the country and the world to a certain extent, and what happened here in Madison in February and March?
I have been following it. I'm actually doing some research this semester on the Occupy Wall Street movement. So I've been following it relatively closely over the last couple of months. And it's been interesting to see that movement progress. And I do think there are some parallels, but that we need to be careful about drawing parallels. Within the Occupy Wall Street movement and reading their literature, they, you know, are presenting a public face of creating an image of moral authority, and that's kind of pulling on previous struggles, Arab Spring being one that they mention, as well as Wisconsin. There's actually an Occupied Wall Street Journal newspaper that some of the activists in New York produced. I think that they've produced 3 issues now. And in the first 2, they have a timeline that runs along the bottom, and it mentions the events of Arab Spring, and it mentions Wisconsin, and there were also anti-austerity protests in Britain and Greece in the spring and in the summer. And so there's kind of drawing connections between various strands of a global movement. But at the same time, I think that there are important differences too. When you talk about Wisconsin, you talk about our livelihoods, you know, that impact. I don't mean to say that talking about Occupy Wall Street isn't talking about people's livelihoods, because it definitely is. But perhaps it's not quite as uniform. You know, in Wisconsin, you had all public sector workers are affected by the provisions of the budget repair bill, both the financial provisions and also the collective bargaining provisions. And there was a very clear target. You know, Scott Walker and the Republicans, there was a clear unifying issue. Perhaps this is more a way that I would draw out the differences between Occupy Wall Street and Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, you had a relatively short time frame, a clear issue, a clear target to mobilize against, being Walker and the Republicans, and you know, stakes that were somewhat high. I mean, Walker could have, you know, if we would have decided to go on strike, for example, Walker could have fired everyone. It is illegal to strike. You know, as a teaching assistant, we can't go on strike. But that is something that that we did discuss as one potential tactic, ultimately deciding not to do that, but it was something that was under discussion amongst other tactics. And so those stakes, I think, are very concrete. You know, when you're considering whether or not you might take a job action that could ultimately potentially get you fired versus Occupy Wall Street, I think it's more diffuse and more perhaps of a, like a lifestyle protest perhaps, or there are elements of Occupy Wall Street that it's kind of activism as a lifestyle. And I don't mean that in a negative sense at all, but that there's a culture around Occupy Wall Street that is very distinct. It's in and of itself, it's drawing on anarchist subcultures, and it's drawing on what had been pre-existing subculture movements that sparked, in a sense, and caught the attention now. But things like general assemblies, consensus, modified consensus decision making aren't things that are new. You know, participatory democracy dates back to the civil rights movement. You know, that idea of collective decision making and who knows, potentially before, but, you know, dating back at least to SNCC and the Civil Rights Movement. But if there's something that about Occupy Wall Street that is very important, and it captured this collective imagination right now in the economic recession in which we find ourselves and the global austerity, you know, austerity pressures going on in countries around the world, and that there are connections between those. But I hope that, you know, you can see I'm getting at some of the differences between mm-hmm. what the stakes are.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. Well, thank you for that. So my final question is to put the ball in your court and to ask if there's anything, you know, whether it's a strong memory, positively or negatively, some things that you've written down that you feel it important to get off your chest, so to speak, and on the record. So any final comments about either the February, March protests themselves or the aftermath?
Well, that's a very broad question, and we've covered a lot.
As you're looking through that, maybe you sort of asked, you answered one of my questions about sort of your future plans academically. A sub question of that is, has this and your previous involvement led you to think that there's going to be some future political activity for you? Not necessarily, you know, running for office, but continuing to be involved in the process in some way. And if so, how do you see yourself being involved in the process?
Yeah, definitely. I do think so. I'm not sure in exactly what capacity. Right now, as I mentioned already, I'm trying to focus on academics and on my research, which unfortunately doesn't leave a whole lot of time in a day for activism. But I have found what we have been able to do this year to be one of the most gratifying and important things I've ever been a part of in my life, and that definitely the movement needs to go on. And that I had a moment a few weeks ago after I on the 15th, which was the first day that we could collect collect petition signatures for Walker's recall, and I had volunteered with the TAA. We had a booth at Union South near here, and the enthusiastic response was overwhelming. I mean, it was the first day, and I assumed there are a lot of people in Wisconsin that would like to recall Scott Walker, but I was still overwhelmed by the amount of the response. We were collecting petition signatures at a rate, when you combine Walker and the lieutenant governor, of about 100 an hour. You know, people that were, you know, from undergraduate students to people that were just visiting campus, you know, all range of ages were coming up and like, is this where I can sign? And there was energy around that day that I hadn't felt since the height of the protests. And so it was good to feel that that movement is continuing. And I want to be part of that. So, you know, I do plan to help out a little bit more with the recall effort. But I think over the long term, it's important to remember that the political process and voting in particular and being part of the democratic process is very important. But it's also not the be-all and end-all of activism, that there are many other things that we need to do both in our daily lives and also in a more systematic way that can make the world a better place. And that the political process is only one piece of that. So I don't know that I'm really answering your question about what I plan to do, because mm-hmm. I don't have a concrete plan other than to say that, yes, I would like to, I plan to be politically active in the future on these types of whether human rights and workers' rights and mm-hmm. democratic process issues.
Okay. So I'll slightly rephrase the last question to end this, and that would be, you've already mentioned several things that I think would be considered sort of key moments, or at least key memories. You just mentioned, you know, we talked for almost 15 minutes, I think, about the day the Senate stripped the fiscal part of the bill and passed the bill. And you talked about some other things in the last interview. So are there other, when you think about the Capitol protest 2011 and you figure this out in your mind. Are there other events that stand out for you? And again, they don't necessarily have to be events that fit on the timeline, but they might be, you know, a moment with somebody or an event that you happen to see in the Capitol that really stood out.
I think more about the people. You know, I worked alongside old friends, you know, people that are in my program or that I had previously known through the TAA or otherwise, and also met so many more people, and that making those connections and, you know, exchanging phone numbers with somebody and then, you know, exchanging text messages and just how, you know, kind of seeing network activism in practice. And I think activism is always networked, you know, and the way that social networks synergize around activism in a crisis moment like that, what was something that really struck me, because those are questions and things that I think about academically in my own research. And so to be able to be part of this, you know, has been very insightful in how I think about my own research as well, aside from personally, you know, feeling invested in the issue. And so I think that that's probably a key thing. I'll give you an example, perhaps a concrete example to finish. So there was one day I was walking by the food table outside of that room 300 Northeast where the TAA was coordinating out of, and I ran into a guy that I had had class with probably three semesters prior. And we're like, oh, hey, oh, yeah, we had class together. And he's a graduate student in the School of Education. And he came up to me later and was like, your website sucks, defendwisconsin.org. And I can help make the website better. And I said, okay, sure, do it. And so he and a couple other individuals from the School of Education then stayed up the entire night and redesigned the defendwisconsin.org website. You know, and so that was a connection that just happened. Like, I happened to have had class with him. We ran into each other, and he helped out. You know, just that synergy of energy in that space was quite amazing. Probably another thing that stands out is that, you know, when the Department of Administration was limiting access to the Capitol, and there was very limited internet access in the Capitol, we actually had a number of Defend Wisconsin TAA meetings in my apartment. I used to live three blocks from the Capitol, and so I was having the publicity media team of the TAA over to my apartment, and we had several rather packed meetings with like 10 people trying to sit anywhere they could in my apartment, and just to have a space that was close to the Capitol to use the internet. It just happened to be my apartment. You know, so just like using every single resource that we have, whether it's text messaging, what, you know, human resources and technological resources to get out the message and to help support the activism and organizing. So I guess those are the things that stand out, that really it's about the people and the creativity that we were all able to bring to what we were doing, and the passion that we were able to bring to what we were doing.
Great. Well, Jill, thank you very much. I think that's a good place to end. So this concludes the interview with Jill Hopke for our Capitol Protest 2011 Oral History Project.